Hello, I'm Martin Kessler, and joining me today is writer-producer, Scorsese historian, Robert Cotto. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's an honor and pleasure to be here.
And, of course, you're here because we're going to be discussing three Martin Scorsese films. And I should say, when we first met, you know, it's always a little bit strange when you're meeting somebody for the first time who's into film, like, what are their tastes, what's their background, what are they into? But I think after, I forget if it was after Movie Trivia or...
It was at the diner.
Screening at the New York Film Festival. It was at the diner. We went and sat down and started talking and immediately kind of clicked over Scorsese's, as of right now, most recent film, Silence. And I think we were very much on the same page for it, which was surprising for me because I hadn't really run across somebody who felt the same way about the film. So I was excited to talk to you about it. And it makes sense to talk about it in context of these three films, which I guess we're calling the Scorsese religious trilogy, Last Temptation of Christ, Kundun, and Silence. And even though religion, it's a big part of the background in, I'd say, most of Scorsese's films, these three kind of bring it to the forefront, right?
Oh, yeah, no, completely.
So how were you introduced to these films?
Well, I had been a Scorsese nut probably since I really just discovered movies. I mean, there was an early period where I was into comedies of, you know, the 70s and the 80s. And then I discovered De Niro through seeing Midnight Run and seeing, you know, just other things, you know, in passing. And then must have been 10 or 11 when I first saw Goodfellas. And I was completely captivated by it. As everybody was, but as a 10, 11 year old, you know, seeing that movie for the first time, it was kind of a jolt. I was also raised Italian and Roman Catholic. So seeing The Godfather and seeing all those movies too, you know, kind of, you know, it was a quick education into movies, but it really was, you know, seeing Goodfellas and actually seeing the poster for Goodfellas as the director selection in the Columbia House Video Club. I don't know if you were, you know, if you remember that, but, you know, the Columbia House Video Club would send you the selection of the month, and it was Goodfellas 1 month, and then you opened up the, you know, the little insert that they gave you, and they had a double feature, which was Goodfellas and Mean Streets. And I remember thumbing through the TV Guide not soon after that, and TV Guide had a section where the movies that they rated 4 stars were, they were profiled, and one of them was Mean Streets, and it was going to be on A&E. So I remember seeing Mean Streets on my little 11-inch black and white television in my bedroom as an 11-year-old and being completely hooked by it. And it was from then that I basically, saw everything that Scorsese did. But the one film that I was not allowed to see was The Last Temptation of Christ, because my mother, who had always said, you know, you can see whatever you want, just don't repeat anything in school, had heard all about, you know, the backlash and the controversy surrounding the film. And she hadn't seen the film herself. Like most Catholics at that time, you know, didn't see the film because, you know, they were told not to. Right. It became like this holy grail in a way, or something that you weren't supposed to see. It was kind of taboo. Mm-hmm. So I didn't see it as early as I saw everything else. And then I remember I had run out of everything. At this point, I was in eighth grade. Casino had come out. I had seen everything, you know, chronologically up to Casino, excluding Last Temptation. I'd even seen, you know, Italian American and his episode of Spielberg's Amazing Stories. So like I had really done the deep dive early, but this was the only one that I didn't get to see. And I finally just, you know, because I'm a Catholic and I felt bad about everything, but I needed her permission. Like I needed my mother's permission to like, let me have this. Like I just want to see it. Right. You know, there's no, you know, it's no big deal. You know, it's just a movie. It's just a movie. It's just a movie. And this went on for a while until she was like, leave me alone. Watch it. Do whatever you want. I don't care. I don't want to know anything about it. Do whatever you want. And I remember watching it for the first time with my childhood best friend who, you know, we were, you know, we went to Catholic grade school, Catholic high school. We both attended separate Catholic universities, and we were just completely transfixed by it. I'm still completely transfixed by it. He dismisses it because he's an outright atheist, but I was just completely blown away mm-hmm. by it. You know, so that's how I came to that. And then I saw Kundun when it came out, you know, in 97, and really just, I've seen Marty's movies dozens upon dozens upon dozens of times, and I watched Kundun today for, I think, the fourth time in my, you know, in my Scorsese quest, because it's just the one that never, that I didn't connect to personally, and I've had a hard time connecting to it personally. And in context of the other two films, I see where it is, but it's not something that I find that, you know, I want to go back to, whereas I probably watch Last Temptation of Christ at least once or twice a year, and
right.
Silence I've watched quite a bit since it came out, because it's just that good for me anyway.
Yeah. I think for a lot of people, Kundun's kind of the odd one out. But I think because I'm a couple of years younger, that was the first Scorsese film I ever saw, which I don't know how unusual that was. I think it helped that it was a film that, like, I was a kid at the time, that a kid could watch, that was pretty... not that it's not violent, there's violence in it, but I think, you know, that was a film my parents were probably okay with me watching when it first came out. And
right.
I got into Scorsese proper just a little bit later. I remember bringing up The Dead when it came out, and then
right after
a couple of years after that, it was Gangs of New York. You know, so like that was kind of a period when I got a little bit more into his films, and then went backward. He maybe wasn't doing his best work, you know, from Gangs of New York onwards. So Silence was one that I'd heard he had been making for. Or tried to make for quite a long time, because like that was gestating since, you know, the early 90s. He wanted to make it since about 1990. So that was one that I'd always sort of heard about and heard it would be in this vein. But I had been kind of skeptical, actually, that it would turn out as well as it did. I was actually really amazed how perfect it was. You know what I mean?
Right. Right. Well, you know, I didn't know what to expect. You know, there was a period where I was like, you know what, I'm going to read the book. I'm going to read the book, and I'm going to go into this so I know what's up. But I wound up not doing it, and I was very happy that I didn't read the book. And I still haven't read the book, and I haven't seen Shinoda's adaptation of it either. Because I just feel like if I see that now, it's not going to be fair to Shinoda, you know, no matter what.
I thought it was going to be the other way around, but I think you're right.
Yeah. I've been of the opinion of the last couple of years, and even before Silence came out, that there was this period of, you know, of Scorsese had this run from 1973 to 1999, where there's these, you know, everything that he did in that period were films that he really, really, really wanted to make. And they all rank among his best work. And then he goes and he does Gangs of New York, which, like Silence and like The Last Temptation of Christ, was this passion project of his that it was the only movie that he wanted to make. Like, I think more than Silence, he wanted to make Gangs of New York more than any other movie that he's ever made. And I remember the hype leading up to Gangs of New York, me personally thinking, oh, this is it. This is going to be the moment. He's going to win his Oscar. He's got a huge budget behind him. He's got Daniel Day-Lewis. He's got Leonardo DiCaprio, who I was always a fan of not because of Titanic, but because of This Boy's Life, because he had De Niro's endorsement. So it was when this was going to happen. And then having Harvey Weinstein behind it, who at that point was the Oscar machine. He was nurturing all these, you know, young, great independent filmmakers who all looked up to Scorsese. The fact that they were joining forces and coming together, I mean, there was no way that that film can fail. And then for whatever reason, it just kind of did. Mm-hmm. Like, it's an entertaining, like, I don't want to say anything bad about Gangs of New York. I wish that it was an hour longer.
I mean, it doesn't sound like a huge insult to say that a film isn't a masterpiece.
No, it's, but in hearing about everything that was going on with the production of mm-hmm. that film in particular, while it was happening, you know, the budget ballooned a little bit. Harvey was very much in, wanted to weasel his way in and be involved in yeah. every little thing. He wanted to fire Thelma Schoonmaker.
He fired Jay Cox as soon as he got involved. You know, and I know Jay Cox was talking a little bit. I went to see him talk when he was.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the things he said was, I don't want to take anything away from what Harvey Weinstein did to women. That was really, really awful. And, you know, you could hear the room kind of go quiet as if he's going to say something that's going to just, you know, completely,
right.
You know, send people running the other way. But he said, you know, but the way he treated artists was really awful. You know, the way he would treat writers and, you know, abuse these creative people was awful too. So,
And that movie really, really fails because of what I would presume to be Harvey's opinion about it. And I've always felt that way. And I, long before the Me Too stuff.
Yes.
You know, long before all of this, I knew that Harvey got in the way. I mean, even Biskin wrote about it in Down and Dirty Pictures. Now, how true that is, I don't really know, because Easy Riders and Raging Bull is very, you know, tabloidish in its execution. But a lot of the stuff that he wrote about Harvey, I mean, seems really spot on. And I know that, you know, Marty didn't want Harvey on the set of The Aviator. Yeah, even though he, you know, they Miramax co-distributed that, and Bob Weinstein, the executive producer, was on that. And, you know, he was just like, no, I don't want him around. Can't get in my way. Got in my way too much, you know, before, and I'm not letting him do it again. And, you know, also the thing about Gangs was, you know, Gangs was supposed to come out December 2001.
Right.
And it didn't because, you know, of a whole mess of things. I think that, you know, 9/11 helped delay it. It might have even been somewhat of, like, you know, fortuitous for them, because they were able to go back and reshoot some things and recut things, you know, together. But I also think that it was kind of detrimental to the film. There's supposedly, you know, there was a cut that they showed for critics between, like, right before it was supposed to come out in that period, that was an hour longer, and that people say was just absolutely brilliant. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't the same film that wound up, you know, coming out. But either way, I digressed a lot about it. But
did sort of lead into that 2000s, 2010s period.
But yeah, no, I think Leonardo DiCaprio really, you know, the films that he made with Leo, you know, are very much entertainment, Hollywood, you know, plot-driven movies. I mean, he even said that Departed was the first movie he made that had a plot. And if you look at all of his films, it's true. You know, I they're entertaining and they're enjoyable, but they're not Mean Streets that bringing out the dead. They're not those films that fall into it. So when, aside from the documentary work, which I think the documentary work is strong, the Dylan doc, mm-hmm. the George Harrison doc, you know, the public speaking is very good, and the 50-year argument is very good.
His journey through cinema, you know,
yeah, no,
fantastic,
and,
yeah.
You know, and then even, you know, and he does have this British cinema one that he has in, you know, that we're still waiting for, the Italian cinema, you know, American cinema vein. I hope that that sees the light of day soon. And I'm sure it will, because it gives them another platform to talk about Powell and Pressburger and that whole thing. But, so going into Silence, I mean, I was a little skeptical too. Because
I think partly the trailer, like those accents, and I sort of said to myself, I don't know about this. Like, I thought it could be, you know, maybe not a disaster, but I thought it could not be the best version of this story. It seemed like, I don't know. Like, I don't know about Andrew Garfield, and I don't know if he's going to pull this
off. Yeah, well, I mean, and then especially if you've heard, like, you know, the other people that he had in mind, you know, for the, you know, the 15, 20 years that,
Benicio,
you know,
Del Toro at one point.
And Daniel Day-Lewis at one point. Yeah. Harvey Keitel at one point.
It was like between every film for a little while, it was like, oh, Silence is going to be his next one. No way he's putting it off to do Hugo. He's putting it off to do this or that. You know, it seemed like...
And he got sued.
That he kept putting off. Yeah, he got sued because
he got continuously sued by the Checky Gory group because they thought that that was going to be the next film that he made, and it wasn't. Mm-hmm. And he went from Gangs, you know, to The Aviator, from The Aviator to The Departed, from The Departed to, you know, the Rolling Stones documentary, to Shutter Island, to Hugo, and they're like, "Come on, man! Like, we've given you all this money to make this film. Where is it?" They sued him, and he wound up, you know, rectifying
it. Pretty much had to at that point.
Well, yeah. Right. But then if you go and you look at the credits of that film, there's like 40 producers on it. And it's because of, you know, situation like that, you know, that, you know, that he got into, you know, that whole thing. So yeah, he was even talking about doing Silence. And even like right after Gangs of New York, there's an interview with him on Charlie Rose where he's talking about bringing out the dead. And he's like, "Well, I'm going to do Gangs of New York, and then I really want to go do Silence." Mm-hmm. So that was almost 20 years ago.
I'd wondered if maybe he was partly putting it off because it was such a daunting project. You know, it can be intimidating facing material like that. You know, if you're passionate about it and you don't want to mess it up.
He talks about how... You know, he needed to figure out the last 20 minutes of that movie. Mm-hmm. And that was what took the longest. And for those of you who were listening and have not seen the film, the last 20 minutes of that movie if the first two thirds of that movie, or the first 2 hours and 20 minutes of that movie is a kick in the stomach, the last 20 minutes of that movie is a second kick in the stomach. Like, it's like, oh my God.
I mean, that's where he brings it all together. And you know, that epilogue, how the film ends, that's not from the book. The book sort of ends very quickly, and it sort of says, you know, this is what happened, almost like an obituary for this priest. And then, you know, Scorsese and Cox got in and created this whole other thing. You know, that, of course, final, really powerful final image of the priest Rodriguez, you know, being cremated as a Buddhist, and in his hands, inside the drum that he's been placed in, his body's been placed in, he's got the little wooden Japanese cross in his hand, like his faith never completely died all those years he had spent living as a Buddhist, you know. So like I was surprised that didn't come from the novel, because that seems like such a sort of literary symbol or invention, but that was created for the film.
Well, and it really comes from Hollywood. You know, I mean, the last shot of that movie is a direct rip of Citizen Kane. It's a direct rip.
That's true, actually.
Of the last scene of the way that Kane ends.
Fire, that zoom in. Yeah, that's right.
And
I hadn't thought about that. But.
Yeah, and it's so fitting, you know, for him. You know, I was shocked by it, actually. I was like, wow, you went there. Oh, and it works. Not only did you go there, and it works. You know, so many people could go there and try and do something like that, and it just completely falls flat. But for that film, I mean, it's funny. I saw, you talk about expectations. I think a lot of people's expectations of that film were very much the same. Like, we really don't want to get into this. And so we're not. I saw it the first time I actually saw one of the first screenings of it in New York, and it was at the VGA. It was like in the first week of December. So it was 3 weeks before it opened. And here we are thinking that my buddy and I, we got there early. He was able to get us in. We got there early. We didn't even have to wait in line. The theater was half empty. And we were just like, oh, okay. But across town, he was also doing like a big Q&A with everybody. So we were like, oh, well, everybody went to that one. No one's here. This is fine. Whatever. So, but we sat there, and you know, from even just the credits, the opening credits, like, he's not wasting any time. if there's nothing showy about this, he's going to bring us into a world that he's never brought us into before and that we probably haven't seen. And the, I mean, even the first frame is powerful. I just, yes. You're like, whoa, here we go.
And you see them torturing these Japanese Christians. And that moment when Liam Neeson as Father Ferreira just drops to his knees, you know, in this sort of anguish, like, you know, right from the get-go, it's going for these very heavy emotions.
Yeah. Yeah. Right away. And the way that it's structured, almost like The Mission meets Apocalypse Now.
Right. Well, it's funny. I watched The Mission not that long ago, just thinking about this movie, partly
right.
Liam Neeson's in both. And there's sort of a similar, it's, you know, a man on a mission type story. These guys going into a foreign place that's maybe potentially hostile, and they're going to bring, you know, bring their beliefs with them. That's what a mission is. The Mission, I was sort of surprised because I hadn't seen it for a while, just how unself-conscious it was about this idea of being a missionary. You know, it doesn't really right. dissect it at all. It's just, you know, they're the good guys basically through the whole way. And one thing I remember being a little bit worried about going into Silence was whether Scorsese was going to shortchange the Japanese perspective, if it was just going to be, oh, you know, they're just the bad guys torturing Christians and these missionaries are the good guys. And it wasn't that at all. It was so complex. And it kind of clicked for me while I was watching, like, oh yeah, this is the guy who went and worked for Kurosawa. He's a Kurosawa alumni. And this is the guy who directed Kundun, which is all about Buddhism. Of course, he's not going to shortchange these ideas. And he's not going to, you know, even if the Christian missionary is the main character, he's not going to give him an easy time. Like, one thing that sort of bothers me about a lot of, I guess specifically like American Christian films, is they're very dumbed down, very easy, you know, morally.
Well, they're pro-Christian.
They're pro-Christian. You know, this, it really, it's just like taking a hammer to these ideas. And it's sort of saying, if they're strong, if there's anything about these ideas that are strong, then they can survive this. You right. know, it's really putting it to the test. And I think people should struggle with their beliefs. You know, if you're going to hold those beliefs as true and as, you know, an essential part of your perspective as a human being, then like you should be able to struggle with them. You know, I think that's a big part of Last Temptation of Christ too. You know, I'm not I'm not Christian, so like my perspective might be a little bit different, but like I find it so moving in Last Temptation, seeing the journey of Jesus. I guess like it treats him more like a literary character, you know, right at the beginning, and has that almost disclaimer saying, like, this is not based on the Gospels. This is based on, you know, the literary work by Kazantzakis,
right?
Last Temptation of Christ, you know, so you can kind of have this conceit, okay, you're watching a character of Jesus, but to see a version of Jesus, you know, after seeing different Bible films, Bible epic type films, and Jesus is usually such like a boring character who never has to struggle, that seeing right. a version of him struggle with his belief in his religion and, you know, somebody who's at the center of this religion, struggle with it. You know, I find a lot of meaning in that and find a lot to connect with it in a sort of universal way that I think, you know, anyone who has some sort of religious belief should be able to connect with. I think one of the best things about it is that you don't necessarily have to be Christian actually to appreciate the story. It sort of works as a dramatic story. You know, it'll take things that usually people sort of have to pick and choose, you know, if it's the Jesus of love or Jesus the rebel or Jesus the sacrifice, and it kind of strings them together to create an arc actually, which, you know, how many versions of Jesus on film actually have a character arc? Like, this is one of the only ones.
I agree. I mean, you know, but it really just all stems from the fact that when other films want to portray Jesus, they want to portray Jesus as, you know, as just divine.
Yes.
And you know, just not that I want to emphasize my Catholicism or lack thereof, but you know,
do.
Well, no, it's
yeah.
Well, you know, the Catholics look at Jesus as both fully human and fully divine. But then there's this contradiction where you take away the divinity of Christ and only look at the humanity of him. That's blasphemous. And that's why a lot of people feel that, or that's why Catholics feel that this film can be considered blasphemous. Right. I don't think it's considered blasphemous because he does understand that he has this divinity, but he didn't ask for it.
No.
You know? And that's the human side of him, of you, of me, you know, trying to grapple with what we were born with. And that's very powerful about the film.
I mean, the last temptation, this idea, like, what is the last temptation that Jesus is faced with? It's that it could be just a regular person.
Right.
You know, that ultimately, like, that's what could be more tempting than that is just to simply be a person and have kids and be happy and work and have a wife, you know, like, that's the temptation of it. And, you know, ultimately is to resist that and say, you know, no, I have to complete this divine journey.
Well, right. And what's so powerful about how it ends is that, you know, and which is very Catholic of our beliefs, is that he gets on his knees and he asks for forgiveness, and God forgives him the way that we are supposed to ask for forgiveness, and God will forgive us. And he does that at the end of the movie. You know, and the way that's all shown is amongst some of, you know, Marty's best filmmaking.
Yes.
Period. You know, and then even for the registration pin in the camera, you know, being faulty, and then the light creeping in, and the way that the film becomes overexposed. It, you know, is one of, you know, and then with Peter Gabriel's score just, you know, coming in. I mean, that, talk about divine intervention.
Right. You know, like, on one hand, I remember sort of the first time I saw it, taking it just as, oh, like, it's maybe just there to show that you're just watching a movie, like, it's okay, don't get too worked up over it. But watching it again, like, the colors of the light leak coming in, like, it's the light coming into the film, it's this bright, colorful, like, it really, it's kind of a joyous moment,
yeah. You know,
that, and then it goes orange with the credits and the music coming in. Like, the tone of it's quite celebratory, actually, and it's sort of an uplifting moment, this idea of him dying on the cross, not something sort of grim. Or, like, I always, in my mind, compare this with the Mel Gibson film, the Passion of the Christ, which I don't like. It's a snuff film. Like, you know, it's Christ is divine in flesh and blood, emphasis on the blood, you know, like, there's no part in that film when he has any doubt, or, like, he's always this sort of, like, boring stoic character, and just, you know, the body suffers and that's it. And you're supposed to be, I'm surprised that so many people seem to be moved by that film, because it's, it's dramatically inert, you know, it's just like the seeing the physical side of that, but the, you know, there's not really any internal struggle, spiritual struggle I found in that film.
Well, I remember seeing that film the day that it opened, and in Times Square. I wanted to go to Times Square to see it because I wanted to be surrounded by the controversy, the people picketing, all of that stuff. And what was funny was there wasn't really anybody out there picketing like they said that there was going to be, except this one group. I'll never forget it. They were called Communists for Jesus. My buddy went up to him and was like, oh, Communists for Jesus, is that really working out for you guys here in America? You know? Right. And I've only seen that film once, and it stayed with me in a way where it felt like going to church. It felt like being at church on Good Friday, hearing the Stations of the Cross, except it was visualized for you by the man who directed Braveheart, who is this, you know, crazy Uber
kind of a guy. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and crazy Catholic to boot. And, you know, so, I mean, I was interested in it. And I also sat there, you know, basically like, oh, okay. So this is the first time he's going to fall. And then, you know, Veronica's going to wipe his face, and then he's going to fall again. And the women are going to come, and then he's going to fall again. And then, you know, but so I basically like, sure. You know, but the things that were moving about the film is the gratuity of the violence. And that's, you know, I mean, they really give him, you know, a beating.
Yeah.
But to me, that wasn't, you know, you didn't need to see that. That wasn't something that needed, that, you know, that people, and yet it's like the highest grossing R-rated film of all time. Mm-hmm. And people think that it's incredible, but there's no, you know, Jesus has, you're 100% correct. Jesus has no character arc. He doesn't struggle. He might suffer, but there's no real struggle.
Right.
He knows what his fate is. You know, at least with the last temptation of Christ,
going through the motions. Yeah.
It's just going through the motions. At least with last temptation of Christ, you know, Jesus has to struggle with what his purpose is.
Yes.
And he struggles with it through the entire movie. He knows that. He knows what his end is, you know, and to the point where he orchestrates it. You know, that was one of the things about The Last Temptation of Christ that I admired so much was the portrayal of Judas and
yes.
that whole relationship. Whereas you hear that, you know, people refer to, well, you're a Judas, it means that, you know, you're a backstabber, that you're a betrayer.
Sure.
Judas, but Judas was his boy. And Judas wanted him to carry forth and move forward. And, you know, they were on a mission.
I mean, it comes from very old beliefs that were suppressed, actually. Like, you know, it's only in recent years when stuff like Gospel of Judas has come out, you know, and that's from, you know, maybe a second century it was written. And I know in the introduction to the book Silence, the novel, Scorsese wrote an introduction for the new edition where he talks a lot about the Gospel of Judas and this idea of being in that role of the betrayer to actually find sympathy for that person. And like a lot of the ideas in Last Temptation of Christ reflect early Christian beliefs that, you know, were basically suppressed when it became, you know, Roman state religion. You had the Council of Nicaea and you had, you know, the Emperor Constantine converting to Christianity, like a lot of stuff got sanitized. So, you know, you have stuff like, again, in Passion of the Christ, Pontius Pilate's like this, you know, generous figure trying to get Jesus off the hook as often as he can. But in Last Temptation of Christ, you know, he's just all business. You know, he's saying, well, you know what I'm going to have to do with you. Like that's one.
Right.
Yeah, I love David Bowie. Only comes in for that one scene, but it's just sort of the perfect portrayal of Pontius Pilate as somebody who's, you know, you think what his role is. Oh, he's a responsible governor. He's just there to govern. He doesn't want to cause trouble. And Jesus, you're a troublemaker. So, you know, you're out. That's it. You know, and I'm sorry to hear that. I don't really have any, you know, hard feelings against you. It's just, you got to go. Like that kind of approach, thinking what these people's roles were, it kind of cuts to a lot of the heart of the truth. Maybe not necessarily historical truth. I don't know, a lot of that stuff's lost, but at least a sort of dramatic truth, you know, with characters like Judas, with Pilate, you know, with, you know, even Paul. I was thinking at the end when Jesus is going through this vision of a life
right.
he could have lived, you know, and he meets Paul, who's sort of saying like, well, I'll create the resurrected Jesus. People need this. And, you know, they talk a lot about how, you know, Christianity, what really propagated
right.
it as a religion was Paul, you know, sort of preaching it to Gentiles. And
yeah, he created the truth out of what people needed.
Yes.
You know, and in a way, it sums up the entire business of the church.
Mm-hmm. So that scene with Judas, like you were talking about the relationship before, but like to me, you know, one of the most powerful moments in the film is when he's asking Judas, you know, you're going to have to betray me. And like he says, you know, that's what God wants, then let God do it. I won't do it. I won't betray my friend.
Right.
He said, well, like God gave me the easy job. I just have to be crucified. You have to play this role of the betrayer. And, you know, that's a character archetype that comes up in so much of Scorsese's films. There's always sort of very often there's like a Judas figure, even in Wolf of Wall Street, you know, you have Jonah Hill being a Judas figure.
Henry Hill's, you know, a big old Judas.
Right. So like, it's interesting, is preoccupation with somebody who, you know, basically has to turn their back on God.
Interrupt me if I'm going the wrong way, but like, I don't find at the end of Silence that Rodriguez has had to betray his God. I just feel like, oh, well, this is what the title's all about. He lives in silence.
Right.
You know, his faith is in silence, and he doesn't need to share his faith with anybody. And it's nobody's business, and this is what he has to do in order, you know, to live and to keep people alive, then this is how much his faith means to him.
Exactly. I think that's completely correct. And like, there's also that Buddhist element that comes into it as well. This idea of, you know, finding something spiritual in silence, like that's, you know, comes sort of from this Buddhist concept of nirvana. And, you know, if you're talking about his conversion to Buddhism in silence, like he actually does find God in a way through being pressured to convert to Buddhism. Like, it's a very ironic journey for him to find God in the silence in the end, and by betraying him. Like, I mean, for me, one of the moments where my jaw really dropped, I think both times I saw it in the theater, I saw it again recently, is when he finally has to step on the image of Jesus to, mm-hmm. to save these Japanese Christians' lives, you know, and God finally speaks, and it's the perfect thing to say. I keep saying this movie's perfect.
Oh, it is perfect.
You know, it's all right. Step on me. Like, you know, basically, what do you think I'm here for?
Right.
You know, that was kind of just the right thing to say, to the point where, like, it was so perfect, it made me think back to Last Temptation of Christ, when he's on the cross and the devil comes as this little angel saying, like, you've suffered enough. You know, it's actually kind of similar to the point where, you know, it made me,
it's incredibly doubt. Similar. And I remember, you know, when I saw Silence for the first time, and just like knowing Last Temptation so well, the way that he played that, go ahead now, step, it busted my mind open. I was just like, yes. Oh, well, Marty's back. This is the Marty that I've always known and always loved. I mean, you know, even from, you know, Mean Streets. You know, you know, you don't make up for your sins in the church. You do it at home. You do it in the streets. The rest is all bullshit. And you know it. I mean, that device that he uses of that voice, whether it's him or whether it's the guy who wrote Peeping Tom, who's the voice of the devil in you know, Last Temptation of Christ. Though I haven't been able to figure out who the voice.
It sounds so familiar. I'm sure I've heard it before. I just can't place it. And there's no credit out there. So.
There's no credit on the film. I can't even begin to imagine who it might be. You know, I was like, is it Max von Sydow? No. Is it Kieran Hines? No. Is it, you know, because, you know, he's in the film. If you're doing something else to do, you know, I have not been able to figure it out. And he hasn't even addressed it either. But no, I don't think anybody's come right out and asked him, like, you know, who's the voice of God at the end of the movie? Because it's not you.
No. But it's almost better not knowing. Like, it's just that voice, and I think
sure.
If you knew the actor behind it, like, it would almost make you want to interpret, like, you know, is it coming from Rodriguez's own psyche? Is it actually God? Is it the devil? Like, you know, it might actually put a spin on how you interpret that moment.
Because right.
I think, like, different people might take something different away from that. But
you know what? I've had a hard time with figuring out which one it is, but I won't. I don't find the need to figure it out, because the bottom line is, it gets him to realize that he needs to do this in order to save the people, in order to be compassionate and not be so selfish and not be so prideful.
Because he starts off so arrogant, like, you know, he knows. I mean, the quote you mentioned, you don't make up for your sins in church, you do it on the street. Like, that almost feels like the thesis for these three films, where you have an idea of religion. Okay, I understand what the principles are. I understand how to practice it. And then when you put it in, you know, in the real world, when you put it into practice, it's a whole different thing. And
right.
It's full of contradictions and complexities. Like, it's only really after, you know, he apostatizes that he can connect with the Kikichirō character, who's the guy who keeps kind of apostatizing and coming back and asking for forgiveness, and he does it several times throughout the film. And you know, at a certain point, you kind of get Rodriguez just being like, like, what, you know, what's the point even? But then he ends up in the exact same place as him,
right? Yeah, the Johnny Boy character of the film,
right?
You know, the one that continues to do wrong and do wrong, and yet Charlie forgives him, and Charlie looks the other way, and Charlie's out there to support him and be there for him, and then he screws Charlie again. You know, it's you know, but that's life.
Yeah.
You know, and I've always been very, that's one of the other things that really that struck me about the film with, about Silence and Kikuchiro, is every time he runs away, you see it from afar, and he kind of runs away the same way. And you're like, man, you're an ass. And then he comes back, and you're kind of, oh, you're back. Oh, why are you here?
Right.
Oh, maybe he'll be, you know, I, as a viewer, forgive him each time.
Yes.
Too, and then, oh, he does it again. And when he finally gets, you know, taken away at the end, you're like, ooh, well.
Like, you finally got it once and for all, yeah.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, I can talk about this movie all night long. That I just didn't expect it to impact me the way that it did, especially, you know, since we see so much stuff.
Yes.
And we're critical about so much stuff. And then there's stuff that we really truly do love, and it really comes few and far between. You didn't expect this to come from him at 75 years old. You know, but look at the films that he was probably watching. I mean, some of your favorites and some of my favorites, I'm sure. Like, I'm sure that he watched The New World and was blown away by Malick. He was like, you know what? I want to make a movie like that. You know, or he looked at There Will Be Blood and the religious aspect of that, and was completely and totally inspired by something like that.
Malick's maybe one of the only other American Catholic filmmakers whose work doesn't suck, I think. You
right.
know, that's sort of, they're in a similar category, even though they have very different backgrounds, but you can see certain commonalities in how they approach some of these subjects. Like the, comparing it to The New World's interesting because of that transition in the culture, how it sort of shifts perspectives. And,
right.
you know, there are moments in Silence when you think you're coming at it just from Rodriguez's point of view, from Andrew Garfield's point of view, and they kind of flip your perspective. Like, there's one part when he's arguing with the translator, who's played by Tadanobu Asano, who I'm glad finally has a good English speaking role.
What a great role, too. I mean,
a fan for such a long time, and he keeps getting, he's in like Battleship and Thor and stuff like that, so it was good to see him in something where he could actually act. But like, he's such a polite character. He's even polite when they're drowning Garupe, you know, he's very formal, polite. But that moment when Rodriguez insults Buddha, say, oh, your Buddhas are just men, like, he kind of snaps, like, you're ignorant, like, let me tell you how it is, you know.
No, right.
You know, moments like that where he's trying to explain to this character how ignorant he is. Or, you know, a lot of these Japanese Christians, when you sort of get the impression that they're better Christians than he is, even, because he starts breaking under these external forces, like when him and Garupe first show up and they're starving because it's this long journey, and
right.
you know, they start stuffing their faces, and you know, the peasants in this village who are Christian stop to pray before eating, and these guys kind of remember their manners, but it's like, yeah, you know, you're supposed to pray before every meal, you're supposed to say grace, but then the hunger kicks in, and it's a different matter. And it's like, when you start actually facing these things, these high ideals get dragged down. And like, he even has kind of like a Jesus complex, you know, when he's looking in the water and he sees his reflection, and
mm-hmm.
you have Kikuchiro selling him out. Like, he starts to think of himself as this kind of savior character a little bit. And, you know,
well, that's really a Christian for you.
Right. And, you know, I think that's like a lot of missionaries. And one thing I like about, you know, these interactions where they go really hard on him, the Inquisitor, or, you know, when Liam Neeson comes back into the picture, Father Ferreira, like, they don't go easy on him, and they really challenge that and humble him. You know, like, the Inquisitor is one of my favorite performances in the film, Issei Ogata. Like, I didn't recognize him. I guess he probably lives in Taiwan, because he's also in Yi, and you know, I haven't seen him in that many films, but like, just each film.
Well, it's Yi, and then it's what's the other one?
The Sun. Yeah, the Sukharov film,
yeah,
Replace Hirohito. Like, each film, he looks completely different. He has, like, totally different mannerisms. And he keeps coming up with these things that, like, I think it must be him. You know, there's a moment when they're having this conversation and they're using the idea of monogamy and wives as a metaphor, right, for, you know, these nations outside of Japan and Christianity. And he just kind of deflates.
Shrinks. Yeah, he deflates. Right, yeah. Like,
you know, he's so not, you know, when you hear the word inquisitor, like, what comes to mind is, like, almost the opposite of this guy. He's small and, you know, friendly, actually, and he
can barely walk.
You know, he just has that idea that, like, oh, I'm, you know, I don't even have anything against you. He's almost like the Pontius Pilate character. I'm just here to crush it. That's my job. I don't want to,
right,
like, you know, and he's saying, like, you know, it's not even practical for me to kill you. Like, I want to break you. That's the important part of this.
Right. Yeah, no. You weren't defeated by me. You were defeated by this.
You were defeated by this swamp of Japan.
Right, what a great line.
Yeah, no, what a great, great line. And back to, you know, Mr. Ogata, I think that that's one of the best performances of the last 10 years or something. Like, you know, if you have to rank, if you have to rank great performances in films, it's like Daniel Day-Lewis in There Will Be Blood, Christoph Waltz in Inglourious Bastards, and Issey Ogata in Silence. Right. Like, It's up to that kind of level.
The way he just embodies this character and, like, his, you know, these sighs that he comes up with.
No,
like,
right.
Like, it's so distinctive. And I don't, like, I know people talked about the film as if it's, you know, they tried to paint it in the reviews, like, even positive ones, that the film's a little bit, like, humorless or, like, doesn't have that much personality. But, like, there's so much just in that one character. I'm surprised it had that kind of reaction. Well, another great performance in the film, I think, is Liam Neeson's. You know, it's not a big part, but just...
No, but it's the movie star role.
And, like, have you seen the movie The Gray from a couple of years ago where he's...
Yeah,
like... There's that one scene in that film that kind of took me off guard where he's praying for a miracle, like, you know, God, prove yourself, like, you know, I'll believe, right, you to, like, I almost, you know, had that in the back of my mind when I was watching him show up in this film again, as if something like that happened, you know, in between that first scene and, you know, when you see him again as a Buddhist, and of course his own personal life, you know, losing his wife, like, he just shows up, he looks like somebody who struggled with this stuff, who struggled with the existence of God. Like, it's just on his face, even.
Yeah, no, and he's an actor that doesn't get enough credit. It's either that he doesn't get enough credit or that people are so just desensitized by
the action movies and stuff like that.
Right,
yeah.
I mean, because even, like, you look at Taken, mm-hmm, you know, take the other six Taken movies, you know, including, like, The Commuter and...
Sure.
You know, whatever, you know, they could all be, yeah, Takens, okay?
Right.
You know, I mean, he's damn good in that first Taken movie. But he's also really good in, you know, lots of other stuff, you know, leading up to Silence. Like, if he doesn't, he's a real actor. I mean, even something like Love Actually, mm-hmm, you know, he's just so sweet and he's got so much, you know, charm to him that when, you know, the movie star shows up in Silence and basically, you know, tells you how it is, you listen.
Yes.
And he commands the screen. He really does command the screen. It's a great performance. It's a great performance by everybody in the picture.
Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any bad performances. Some are more standouts than others, but, like, everyone's perfect at it, you know?
Yeah. And for me, I mean, it was also, you know, it's one of the few films of the last decade, I'll say. It's one of the few films that has forced me to go and look at other things that I either hadn't seen in a long time or had never heard of or hadn't seen, you know, ever. You know, like, I saw, you know, I discovered, because of this film, I discovered Shinya Tsukamoto, right, who's a fabulous filmmaker in his own right. I had never seen Tetsuo. You know, but I did see.
It's pretty wild stuff.
Yeah. You know, it is pretty wild stuff. Ichi the Killer, I discovered, you know, through this as well, which truth be told, was too violent for me. But yet Marty's such a huge fan. I was like, oh, Ichi the Killer, I mean, that's such a great film, you know? And
well, he was in all these films in like the early 2000s SNO, like Ichi the Killer, of course, but he was in the Zatoichi remake. He was in Oshima's last film. So he was in all this great stuff. And it's just like, I think in America, he's just, even though he keeps kind of showing up and stuff, I don't think he's had that role that people have taken notice of, but it's there in silence if people want to take a look.
No. Which is, you know, and that's the most disappointing thing about silence for me and its reception.
Yes.
You know, it wasn't at all controversial, so there was no reason for people to avoid it, and yet people avoided it. And, you know, Scorsese is a director, American filmmaker for me, that I feel that as a culture, if Scorsese makes a movie, you go and you see it. No questions asked. It's the same thing as if Bob Dylan makes an album, you listen to it. If Marty makes a movie, you see it. Most people go see Spielberg's movies. Most people go see James Cameron's movies. Most people go and see, I don't know if you can, Quentin Tarantino's movies, but for whatever reason, people avoided this one.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult film to figure out how to market at all, but Scorsese, like a lot of the films that seem to have the biggest following, it's stuff like Goodfellas, Casino, like the crime films especially. And
it's also stuff for all the wrong reasons.
Right.
You know, I want to touch on that in a minute, but, you know, back to Silence and its reception. You know, it was shocking that the movie made as little money as it did, considering that Andrew Garfield was in it, it was his follow-up to a massive hit in Hacksaw Ridge that people loved. Like, people loved that film, which, it was fine. You know, I was shocked. He got nominated for that film, too, and when he got nominated that morning, they were like, Andrew Garfield for Hacksaw Ridge. And I was like, silence. He got nominated for the wrong film. And then Adam Driver, who is in everything with everybody.
He's in Star Wars now. Like, he's a big star.
He's in Star Wars. How come the Star Wars, you know, pastiche isn't carrying this? Not to mention that he, you know, he's on Girls, which he was the best thing about Girls.
Right, he was.
You know, I mean, for a show called Girls and having Adam Driver be the best thing about it. I mean, and it was a hit show. I mean, you would think that people would, as a culture, be like, oh, wow, he's a great young actor. Let's go see what the great young actor is doing.
Yes.
You know, and then to have Liam Neeson, who's just in stupid movie after stupid movie after stupid movie,
that come out in January, make a pile of money.
Right. You know, and you know, so, you know, that was frustrating. I mean, granted, I had thought that after I had seen it, you know, in the year of Moonlight and Manchester by the Sea and La La Land, you know, it didn't have a chance. You know, it was rushed out. You know, Paramount had to push it out because Brad Grey was imminently being let go because he was dying. And he had basically shepherded Scorsese's career from the moment that he won, you know, the Oscar on. Gave him that deal at Paramount, which allowed him to make this film. I had always thought that, you know, it was rushed out, and had they had just waited 4 or 5 months and rolled it out at Cannes last year, more people would have seen it and more people would be talking about it the way that you and I are talking about it.
I think that's probably right. I mean, so much of a film's reception seems to be caught up in the way it's released and promoted. Like, it, in some ways, it's very frustrating that the baggage around a film's release seems to matter so much, but it does.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even remember. What won Best Picture last year? Shape of Water? Silence is totally a better film than Shape of Water.
No question. I don't, you know, any question at all.
And even loving Phantom Thread, like, you know, no question about it. Silence is totally a better film, you know, but when you're up against something that's happy and go lucky, like, you know, La La Land, and then something that is, you know, incredibly, you know, a new voice and well done, like Moonlight, you know, how do you compete with that? Especially if people aren't going to see your film.
I mean, some of the film, like, we haven't talked about Kundun yet that much, but, like, that one, I remember the release also getting a little bit caught up in controversy and that perhaps hurt the film.
Well, that all had to do with China, you know, with China. Yeah. And their depiction of, you know, his accurate depiction of China. Right. And how they felt about it and how they, you know, basically, you know, told Disney, like, you put this movie out, we're not going to do business with it.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, very similar to, you know, the backlash that MCA, Universal received when, you know, The Last Temptation of Christ came out. Like, you know, Blockbuster Videos. Like, we're not putting
Disney issued an apology just for making the film. Like, and now it's hard to find, actually, on the home video. It's sort of been...
Yeah, no, well, I know that Kino is doing a Blu-ray of it.
Maybe last year that they were going to be working on it. Yeah,
and that it's supposed to come out sometime between now and the end of the year. And I guess that there's a 4K scan of it too, which is great because the home video presentation of it now is, you know, there's more to be desired. You know, it's unfortunate that, you know, something like Criterion couldn't get their hands on it, but I don't think that Criterion would think it's up to the level of, you know, their excellence.
I mean, in some ways I'm relieved because it'll cost me half as much to...
No, understood.
But, you know, but like, I think it totally could have been, and especially like, you know, that was early Roger Deakins cinematography. It looks, you know, I think of these three films, it's incredibly sumptuous. Each film has a different cinematographer. I don't know if you want to talk a little
bit about that. Well, yeah, no, I mean, you know.
It kind of has its own feel, like,
yeah, well, Ballhouse is...
Ballhouse who shot Last Temptation. And like that, he had shot other films for Scorsese, but to me, Last Temptation is the one that kind of reminds me the most of what the way Fassbender's films look.
Right.
The ones he had shot for Fassbender, because it's so down and dirty. And, you know, instead of a low budget hurting the film in the way that it could have, I think it actually helped make the film feel down to earth and grounded and intimate. You know, it's not a film that falls back on the kind of tradition of Bible epics where we're going to throw in spectacle and, you know, show this like large scale. I mean, Scorsese sort of half jokes about, you know, using the same five Romans for the entire film.
I love it. I think it's one of the best. It's really guerrilla filmmaking at its best, you know, and even someone like him, if he can admit that this is how we were able to, you know, pull this off. And it works, you know, that means that, you know, anybody could do it. You know, that's the other thing about him. You know, he never relied on having big budgets. You know, he got very lucky in the last 15 years of having big budgets, you know, that most of them were, you know, were front loaded by the studios and basically covered talent expenses more than anything else. And, you know, when he talks about Silence being, you know, people talk about Silence being a $46 million movie. You know, $26 million of that money went to lawsuits, went to paying people off, went to the options that he, you know, that he held on the film for as long. That's a $20 million film.
And
at the end of the day,
you know, with the middle budget films disappearing, like that's like $40 million, even if it was that much on production, like that's a low budget now these days.
No, totally
become a lower budget now that you have films with these multiple $100 million films. And like I think for a long time he hadn't had big money makers. I think like it might have been The Aviator that was his first film to cross $100 million or something like that.
But, well Gangs crossed $100 million, but it didn't matter. And then The Aviator was his first $100 million, like, you know, in the positive. But he even talks about how there was a $500,000 overage that he wound up having to pay out of his own pocket. You know, and then they go and they make Departed. You know, and, you know, that's a massive success for him. And, it, you know, I've heard him talk about money. And, like, I know he lives here in Manhattan and it costs a lot of money to live in Manhattan. So that's one thing. But on the other hand, takes a lot of money to keep all that money. And he has always struck me as the kind of person that doesn't have the money that Spielberg has. That he continuously puts all of his own money back into his films. And all the money that he made on Wolf of Wall Street, went to silence. Like, just, right. Like, that's it. Whatever he was able, you know. And then Jay Cox, I mean, Jay doesn't get enough credit at all.
I mean, and anywhere. Last Temptation, he doesn't get any credit.
He doesn't get any credit at all. Right. And even Paul Schrader was like, yeah, he should have gotten a screenwriting credit on it, but I guess that because of some WGA rules that he, you know, he couldn't. Didn't
change enough, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, Jay Cox really deserves, you know, an enormous pat on the back for Scorsese's entire career. I mean, he's the one that introduced him to John Cassavetes. Cassavetes became, you know, Scorsese's mentor. Jay Cox is also the one that introduced him to Robert De Niro.
Right.
At a dinner party.
I think he said his wife introduced him.
Well, Verna Bloom. Yeah, Mrs. Yeah. Warmer.
Mary.
Yeah.
Virgin Mary in The Last Temptation.
And she's in After Hours as well.
Right.
You know, the work that he did on, you know, all those films, you know, just being his best friend, just being there.
Yeah,
you know?
He still says, like, he's my best friend. We've been best friends for the past 50 years, you know.
Yeah.
That's a really rare kind of relationship to have, creative partnership, friendship. And his contributions, like, he seems like a pretty humble guy. Like, he does downplay a lot of his own contributions, but, like, right. You know, coming up with the cross at the end of Silence, or, you know, some of these are huge, huge additions. I know, right. He was talking a bit about, like, how he had adapted Age of Innocence, and he's sort of saying, like, well, I basically just, you know, broke the book down and turned it into the film. Like, I'm like, give yourself a little credit. You know?
They talk about how they wrote that adaptation in, like 17 days or something. Yeah. which is incredible to me.
Yeah,
Jay's the man, you know, and he was a great critic in his own right. You know, he really, you know, I met him actually at a screening that Marty, he introduced Marty, who's introducing The Bicycle Thief at the Academy here, and I got to go up to him at the end of the night, and I asked, this was about 8 or 9 years ago, and I went up to him and I said, so what's going on with Silence? And he said, oh, you know about that. He goes, well, Marty's trying to make it. And, you know, if anybody could pull it off, it's going to be him. And I was like, well, you're the man. You got good taste. And he goes, I have good taste, really? And then we started talking about certain music that I knew that he was into. And he had told me, I heard little Steven Van Zandt tell the story about how he introduced him to John Cassavetes too, and we got into this whole conversation about Cassavetes. It was cool to actually get to speak to him for a moment.
He's somebody who's, like, even people he hasn't worked with, he's just been in that group of, you know, the movie brat generation. Like, he knows everyone in that group, and he's been friends with everyone to some extent or another.
And I also believe, yeah, he was a script doctor on Titanic.
He's worked on a lot of stuff he's not credited on. You know, I'm not sure,
yeah,
what exactly, but I think he's been associated with a lot of projects, and he's somebody, it seems like, he'll bring people to their attention. Like, he talked about, you know, going to see Heathers and calling up Scorsese to be like, hey, you should check out this Winona Ryder actress or stuff like that. Nice. It seems like he's that kind of a guy, you know. But
he tells this great story on the Criterion commentary for The Last Temptation of Christ, about seeing The Last Temptation of Christ at the Ziegfeld on opening day with a paying audience. And how,
armed guards, yeah.
Yeah, with armed guards and, you know, protesters outside, which there's really cool pictures of people protesting that film outside the front of the Ziegfeld. Google it later. It's crazy. The insane people that are out there protesting a movie they absolutely know nothing about. But he said that when the movie ended and the credits rolled, it was the first time that he ever saw a paying audience, non-industry, give the film a standing ovation. And it was, you know, he was so proud of that moment and being there. And it was so, you know, he was so humbled because his best friend at this point was, you know, under, you know, very tight security, had bodyguards, was receiving death threats, you know, but it was that moment that they knew, or that he knew, that they had made a really great film.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, no, I'm, you know, so that's always, that's just such a cool story, you know, that Jake tells.
But that was interesting that he was introducing bicycle thieves, because, like, I know De Sica was a big influence on Kundun, especially, like, the idea of working with mostly non-actors. Like, there's very few professional actors in the film. It's, like, a lot of real Tibetans. Like, on one hand, like, I think it's sort of a big challenge, especially because the film's all in English.
Right.
But, I find, like, a lot of the performances are really effective, and especially the more naturalistic stuff, like the way he directs the child actors. He's good at that, actually.
I was watching, so I watched Kundun today in preparation of our discussion, and then I followed it with, there's a documentary that Michael Henry Wilson made called In Search of Kundun with Martin Scorsese, where so it's a behind the scenes thing.
And he's just, like, pulling his hair out over these kids, not acting.
But then when he's with the kids, he's so calm and cool and happy to direct them. Mm-hmm. And I found that to be touching. Because, I mean, I've heard stories about him that he's not the easiest person, you know, on a set sometimes, and that he could really, you know, have a fit. I've also heard that he just sits in Video Village too a lot too, and is hooked up to to oxygen because his asthma is so bad still. So, you know, but that was nice to see. And yeah, no, I agree that the performances are very naturalistic, and, you know, he's always, you know, prided himself on working with non-actors, and not just in that film, but even, you know, Raging Bull and Goodfellas and, you know, a lot of those guys in Raging Bull aren't actors, you know, and actors would get mad at him. Like, wait a minute, why are you giving these non-actors jobs? Like, we're actors. We need to work. He's like, I'm sorry, it just doesn't work that way here. I mean, you know, it's not right for my vision. It's not right for the film. He's always been really dedicated to, what's right for the film.
It makes sure that the film has a certain sense of integrity, authenticity, you know, that's trying to reconstruct something, trying to, you know, when he's talking about, for instance, the matte paintings in the film, like, I thought that was really impressive, Kundun, those matte paintings, because it almost doesn't, part of it's that I don't have the best quality version of the film, but, like, I don't even think of them as matte paintings when I'm watching it. It almost puts it in that tradition of, like, Black Narcissus and stuff like that, you know, or, like, I thought a little bit about, some of David Lean's later films in that kind of scope and grandeur, and the way he creates a sense of scale for a film that's, I don't think that had a huge budget either, and it also has this sort of more intimate approach, a bigger budget than Last Temptation, of course, but...
a $28 million budget. It wasn't, and $28 million in 1996, 1997, coming off of, $65, $70 million budget in Casino. It really works.
At the same time, there's so few concessions to, like, a general audience, you know. There's no big stars, there's no, it just seems like he made exactly the kind of film he thought was right in this instance. And, like you said, it's not really a... Earlier you mentioned that, like, he doesn't do films that have a plot, really, and this is kind of...
It's episodic.
Not so much a plot. It's episodic. You know, it's a, you can say it's a coming-of-age story. It's a, maybe even a little bit of a rise and fall. Like, some of the stuff even, again, Citizen Kane, maybe think of, leaving your home and becoming a... How to become a great man. Like, the film I actually think of most when I watch it, because I'd seen them around the same time for the first time, was The Last Emperor, the Bertolucci film, and how they're almost divergent depictions of somebody who's very young finding out that you're our leader, basically, and how, in The Last Emperor, I think there's a scene where he asks a eunuch just to drink ink to prove that he has this power over somebody, and turns into kind of a brat, and just somebody who's so ill-suited to lead a nation. And, like, Kundun sort of shows you how somebody very young could grow into that role of being a political leader, spiritual leader. Like, when he's a kid and he finds out that he's Dalai Lama, and, he acts a little bit spoiled in one or two parts. Like, his dad right. kind of lets him push him around, and I'll buy those sheep. And his mom comes in, and she just puts him right in place because, you know, it's his mom. She says, like, you know, that's not how you talk to people. You know, and he's like, I'm in charge. And she goes, of whom? You know, and it just kind of humbles him. And he has a lot of these teachers who humble him and have faith in him, you know, the way that people have faith in Jesus in Last Temptation. Like, there's that one moment where he asks Noble, one of his teachers, basically, or, you know, one of the people who's looking after him, do you ever wonder if they found the right boy? And he says, no.
Right.
To understand that people have that kind of faith in you, it's a huge amount of pressure, but there's also a lot of strength to draw on that. You know, I think that the film shows that, you know, a little bit of a contradiction, you know, or at least makes you understand how isolating that is, but how it can make a very strong person, how it can forge a strong person. You know, a lot of the interactions he has, you know, that there's a kind of theology that I think people get a little bit hung up on when they watch the film, because they're reciting, you know, Buddhist texts, and, you know, they're talking about Wheel of Samsara and things like that, which I think a general audience might not be familiar with. But I think that stuff's not actually important. It's like the little life lessons that come in between that stuff, you know, or it's the kind of maturing effect of having to perform first rites on your own father. And,
right.
you know, the man who finds him, Redding, I think it's a title, it's not like a name, but Redding, when he's
imprisoned,
basically profiting off of him, and then he gets put in prison and killed in prison. Like, you know, he's very quickly, as a young boy, getting this understanding that the world is a flawed place. And, you know, maybe it's my job to actually feel for these people. You know, they tell him that that's your job, to be the deity of compassion, basically. So, you know, when he sees that prisoner with the shackled feet praying down to him, he prays back, and he sort of, even just in the immediacy of Tibet, trying to learn how to fix the world around him. And, you know, there's that whole interaction. Like, one of my favorite sequences in the film is when it goes to China, because this idea of socialism, Marxism, it's actually appealing to him. You know, that sounds sort of appealing to an idealistic young man, the way it does for a lot of people. And then, you know, he's talking to Mao, and Mao just has that one moment, you know, because he's very persuasive, and he just lets his guard down and says, religion's poison, in that one moment. And he's framed by the red curtains, and like, oh, he's Satan. You know, it just kind of clicks, and you have that very eerie moment when Mao's waving goodbye to him, and you just know that, like, he's there to destroy everything that the Dalai Lama stands for, and it kind of registers with him only at that moment. And I thought that was a line made up for the film, but apparently that really...
That conversation really did take place.
So, you know, that's quite a eerie moment. But, like, it's interesting, this sort of journey of seeing somebody basically just learning how to be a good man, and then how you find the spirituality in that. You know, that final exchange in the film, when he's crossing the border and the border guard asks him, like, are you the Lord Buddha? Like, it's a very unusual moment, eerie moment. You know, it's like, you know, if you had to ask somebody if they're God or not, coming face to face with you, and he says, well, I'm just a monk, a simple man. I think I'm a reflection.
Right.
You know, when you see me and I try to be a good man, you see yourself. And there's so many things in Kundun that I find tied back into Silence. Like, even, of course, that line about the reflection, you know, that you have Rodriguez in Silence looking in the water and seeing his reflection as Jesus instead of his own reflection. And, you know, there are little things like that that I find, in some ways, it helps to look at both Kundun and Last Temptation to better understand what he's doing with Silence. Like, it feels like he's created these two separate films that he sort of smashes together, and that collision is where you find the drama in Silence.
Right.
The Christianity clashing with the Buddhism, like this idea of finding the spirituality in the silence again. You know, there's that moment in Kundun when the Chinese first invade, and you have this, like, loud, blaring, obnoxious Chinese music, and the Dalai Lama says, they've taken away our silence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for them, the silence, it's not unbearable. That's where you find the spirituality and what you sit quietly and meditate for, you know. And for Rodriguez, like, the silence of God, it's almost unbearable for most of it. you know, until he reaches that point near the end of the film.
Right. Right. The one thing I was struck by convening watching it today was the innocence of seeing all of this through a young man's eyes, or really through a child's eyes and younger man's eyes. And it's also, you know, a film, you know, about nonviolence, which
yes.
is counter to basically everything that he's ever done. You know, there's a funny story about how we need to show the Dalai Lama one of his films because, right. you know, they need to, you know, he needs to know, so what are we going to show him? you know, and they couldn't show him Raging Bull. You couldn't show him Goodfellas. You couldn't show him Taxi Driver, you know. And then at the end of the day, they didn't show him anything. They just knew that he was a well-respected, you know, filmmaker and right. he was going to do the job.
Right. I mean, there's, he does, the Dalai Lama also in the film has this sort of more advanced understanding as he gets older of just the violence in the world. Like the moment when he hears about the Redding's attempted coup or whatever right. it was, when he finds out that monks have guns, you know, it's such a
monks have guns,
you know, and like he's very, in some ways naive, like you mentioned, when he hears that, oh, we have 5,000 soldiers in our army.
And oh, that's a lot.
Him, like, that's a lot. Like, that's so many people. And, you know, we know that that's basically nothing. You know, and when he's talking to the one guard who has a scar on his face.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he has this sort of a stock answer that violence is never the answer. And, you know, this guy with the scar on his face, he said, well, you know, what do we do that's bad? You know, and nonviolence takes a long time, but do we have the time? You know, right. he sort of understands that it's more complicated than just saying violence is always bad. And like the Dalai Lama just in life, I know, like he took a little bit of flack for not condemning some of the more violent protests that have happened in Tibet in recent years. So like he's somebody who has a little bit more, I guess, a pragmatic outlook. You know, he's a modern thinking person, which the film sort of alludes to. And he's modern in certain regards that I think maybe, you know, show that the country would have modernized quite a bit under him if it hadn't been invaded. You know, like he's saying at the end of the film, we were about to change on our own. Like, we don't need somebody to come in and change us.
Right.
You know, you can't liberate us. We can only liberate ourselves, he says to the Chinese general official. You know, he had some vision for the future that was going to fix a lot of the problems, you know, probably would have. I like the scene where he's discovering all the gifts from foreign nations and he's just learning that there's a world outside of Tibet. And when he's watching those silent films,
mm-hmm.
I think one of them, it's a Georges Méliès film, right?
Yeah, no, I thought that was one of, was a Méliès film. And then he was watching something else, which I believe he was watching.
Is that some sort of Crusader film or?
I want to say he was watching it. He watches stuff more than once, right?
Yeah, there's a few scenes of him watching films.
I think he watches Henry V, too.
Probably. I forget.
I may be confusing it, but you know.
But I have that image in my mind of, like, the statue of Buddha on one side and the,
right.
you know, this film where Méliès is made up to look like a devil on the other. So you have
right.
Buddha's and devils, and that comes up throughout. So, and then, of course, you have Méliès coming up in Hugo. So, like, it's interesting to see little connections to Scorsese's other films in it, or even like moments like when he's looking at Mao's shoes,
mm-hmm.
you know, what you can tell about a person by their shoes, like that brought me right back to New York, or there's just like moments like that.
The moment in Goodfellas where, you know, his mother yeah. sees him, Henry Hill's first time dressed like a gangster, and you know, see the black shiny shoes.
Yes. Yeah. So, and I know Scorsese himself mentioned the flash bulbs going off
yeah.
as being something violent, like the punches, like Raging Bull. So people who kind of treat it as like the redheaded stepchild of Scorsese's filmography, like I think it fits in better than some people give it credit for. And
I agree yeah. with that. I mean, I don't, you know, like I said, of the three that, you know, we were focusing on today, it is my least favorite of this three. I don't know how quickly I'm going to go back to it after talking about it right. at length today. I might go back to it again. You know, yeah, I mean, I guess it's considered the redheaded stepchild of his films, but it did get 4 Oscar nominations.
Right.
It, you know, it boasts an incredible, you know, score from Philip Glass. You know, Dante Ferretti did...
Philip Glass score is incredible.
Like, it really is.
Stretch. It's one of those instances where the music and the editing are just working together so perfectly to mm-hmm. drive everything forward. It's like this huge engine moving the film forward. It becomes... it almost drops behind all the narrative stuff, and it becomes this sort of, you know, pure cinema sequence towards the end, which I think is really great.
Or, you know, the sequence with the sand and
the mandala, yeah.
Yeah.
It kind of makes that correlation between the mandala being swept away and losing Tibet. Like, again, you know, you can hear these Buddhist principles about, oh, you shouldn't be attached to objects, but, like, when you put that into practice and you're losing a country, like, that's a whole nother... thing. It's really something else when once you actually have to make good on these teachings and make good on these principles. And the whole invasion thing, like, there's some stuff I can relate to more strongly, like the country where I'm from, you know, like when my dad was a kid, he got woken up in the morning because there were Russian tanks in the streets.
Uh-huh.
And the world didn't care, it just happened, and
right,
you know, nobody did anything about it. Like when he's, you know, in the film when the Dalai Lama's writing and trying to get somebody to help them, just help them, they said, well, India can't help, Britain won't help, you know, America will see. And
well, and it's funny because, you know, how, you know, talking about, you know, China in relation to this film, and how, you know, this film really takes, the bulk of this film really takes place, like, you know, 60, 70 years ago, you know, how soon, you know, how quickly we've forgotten.
Yep.
The way that China is, you know, with our country trying to, you know, do deals with China, you know, now it's like, you know, take a look at history and take a look at what's going on. You know, there was something on the Today Show here in New York this morning, you know, talking about how how the generation below us doesn't know what Auschwitz is.
That scares the shit out of me. Stuff like that,
you know, and the fact that they don't have any idea what that is, you know, you're right. It's scary, but it also allows for history to repeat itself,
right?
You know, and people talk about how, well, we want to go to the movies to escape. We don't want to go to the movies to, you know, have to think or have to feel sad or whatever.
Be confronted,
or be confronted. But maybe there needs to be more movies. Like a Kundun or like a Silence, where you have to be confronted with this stuff happened and it can happen again, mm-hmm. you know? And it brings me to a point that I wanted to touch on before. You know, I've found that the biggest detriment to Scorsese's filmography is that people take the wrong morals more away from his films more often than not.
Yes.
You know, you look at something like Goodfellas or Casino and you don't realize that he's depicting bad people and that these things have consequences.
He doesn't come out and make a big statement at the end that, oh, this is bad. Like, he just leaves it for you to take something away. Like,
And even look at something like The Wolf of Wall Street, which for me, from a filmmaking, you know, from a critical assessment of all his work, it's something that I would rank rather low, but right. except for the Quaalude sequence, which is one of the greatest things he's ever done. Like, I don't care.
I like the slapstick stuff in that. That's pretty great when he's going down the stairs.
Or certain cutaways are hysterical. Like, there's certain moments in that film where he's never been funnier, but it's the final shot of that film that really needs to slap more people in the face, where he's just panning on this crowd of people who are just held
on the audience. Yeah.
Yeah. This crowd of people who are held on what Jordan Belfort's going to say. And for what? So you could, you know, have sex on a plane, do a lot of drugs, you know, have a lot of money, you know, live fast and, you know, but how did he get there? No, he robbed you. He stole from you. He stole from other people. Just for what? You know, to get off on a plane. You know, like, this is what this is about. But I think that, you know, people don't take that, you know, people don't take that moral away. You know, there's a lot of people out there who are pissed right now at Robert De Niro because he went on TV and said F Trump. And it's like, oh, well, I'm sorry. I'm sorry that Robert De Niro is not the gangster, racist character that you want him to be. No, he's someone that has ideals and morals and wants to, make the world a better place. He's not Jimmy the Gent. He's not Travis Bickle. He's not Jake LaMotta. He's married to a black woman. You know, he's not racist, you know, and that's the biggest thing that I've noticed amongst people our age, people who are older, that they dig the glamour of these films, but they're not really hearing the message.
There's people I know, they talk about Scorsese like he's filmmaking God, but you try to get them to watch, Age of Innocence, and it's like pulling teeth, you know? Like, there's just some films in his filmography, like King of Comedy, I found that's one that people have come around more on recent years, but for a while, I would talk to people who didn't even know it existed.
Right.
I think now that, of course, De Niro's in it, and like people have kind of come around on it, but like... I think Kundun's just one of those ones that's been lost a little bit more in that
filmography.
I'm worried Silence, it's going to end up being kind of the same thing, because there wasn't even the controversy around its release. It was just kind of met with a weird apathy.
Well, that's not going to, not if I have anything to do with it. I mean, I've kind of made it a mission to try to talk about it with anyone who would listen.
Yes.
Because it's, we have mutual friends that I don't think share our enthusiasm over it. But I think that if some of them sat through it again, they might. Or if they see it on a big screen, they might. Rather than seeing it on a small screen or seeing it, on their phone or whatever. I think that's a detriment to movies at this point, especially a film like that.
I mean, I was so lucky, like they had the Jay Cox screening because it was their books on film series. Mm-hmm. They were talking about adaptations and, I lucked out because when I saw Silence the first time in the theaters, it was pretty close to the end of the run. Like it was one of those films that just kind of came and went really, really quickly. I didn't even get a chance to see it a second time, even though I wanted to on the big screen. And, of course I wasn't going to miss the chance this time. And you do notice things on the big screen that you don't necessarily notice when you're just watching on a small TV. Like at the end, I had to watch carefully this time, but you can definitely see the wife when she puts the paper, inside the vase where Rodriguez is, body is, you can see her slipping the cross, and I like just noticing something like that, because it's a really fine detail that's made to be observed on the big screen. And then you can kind of think back to that conversation he had with the Inquisitor about Christianity as a wife and monogamy, and I like that, even though she doesn't have a line in the film, it's the wife that kind of preserves that Christianity for him, and things like that. Like it's made to be appreciated on the big screen, so it's just stuff like that does get lost when you watch it on the smaller screen.
Have you caught Scorsese's cameo?
Yes. Yeah, he's with the...
he's the Dutch. He's one of the Dutchmen.
Dutch near the end. I think he's got... Kunduni doesn't have a cameo, but he's also in Last Temptation.
Yeah, but he's covered.
He's all covered. You just see his beard, but once you know it's him, you can notice it.
It's so great. I love his cameos. His cameos are on par with Hitchcock's cameos.
He's got some pretty great ones.
One in After Hours is great, too.
One in After Hours is fantastic. I like when he shows up as an actor, too. I think he's sort of underappreciated as a character actor. Like, I love him in Quiz Show.
Yes.
What does he say? Queens isn't New York? Or...
Or when he's in The Muse.
The Muse is great.
Raging Bull with a really thin guy.
What is it? Guilt by Suspicion.
Oh, Guilty by Suspicion, where he plays the director.
He's great in that one little part, and of course, Kurosawa's Dreams, which we mentioned earlier, like him is a very impatient Vincent van Gogh.
So. Which is funny, because Kurosawa was impatient waiting for him to come and shoot on Dreams, because he ran over schedule on Goodfellas.
Yeah.
And had to finish up and basically was waiting for Marty to show up.
And I heard he was reading Silence on the Bullet Train.
On the way back.
On the way back and...
Going through Japan.
When he made the decision to make Silence. So it's interesting coming off of that, you know... I mean, you feel like the film project was like that little cross that Rodriguez holds at the end. Like, it was just there with them the whole time waiting to get filmed.
Yeah.
But I don't know. And there's, like, stuff... I remember we... I talked to somebody who had seen the film before I had on the podcast. We did our year in review.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, like, oh, like, you know, how much you'll get out of the film depends on, like, whether or not you're Catholic. But, like, again, I'm not. And I get so much out of this film and... You know, the clash of cultures are, again, like, relating to personal things. You know, like, during the Holocaust, like, my grandfather, you know, basically gave up being Jewish. He had people, had the people in the town, I think church fake him baptism papers, and the town, not even a mayor, it was, like, village elder, basically, fake a birth certificate, and, like, he just stopped being Jewish. You know, there's no... apostatizing, but that was basically, you know, you had to hold who you were, you had to hold your faith on the inside for that period of time. You know, it was a little bit like this character, what he experiences. So I think, you know, Scorsese is drawing on his own personal background, and that helps make it feel specific, but it's his application of it that I find very meaningful and potentially universal. Like, I don't think these films are necessarily, like, I think, you know, of course, if you're Catholic, you're going to get a lot out of them, but you don't have to be to appreciate these films.
I agree. I mean, like I said, you know, before, I'm not, like, I don't want to thrive, I don't want to harp on it, but I, you know, yeah, I mean, I grew up, you know, I grew up as a Roman Catholic. I was educated through a Catholic school and even a Catholic university, you know, and really at the end of the day, not by choice, it just happened that way. I mean, you know, but, you know, I did, you know, go to church and, you know, I did serve God and, you know, the traditional, you know, Catholic way. And yet, as I've gotten older and I distanced myself from the church, I still found, By seeing Silence, I was able to understand the Catholic part of it, but I was also really, really proud that I was free thinking enough that I could be objective to the whole Buddhist side of it. And, you know, when people want to just dismiss it as, you know, a Catholic film and not go near it, you know, well, that's unfortunate because then you just really don't want to think. You know, you don't want to, you know, come up with your own conclusions. I think The Last Temptation of Christ, you know, is another one that, you know, is kind of hindered by, you know, a Catholic way of thinking.
Like, Schrader's a Calvinist, so, like, you do kind of get some push and pull between those perspectives. Like, I think some stuff in it's so Schrader, too. Like, I was thinking about that line when Jesus is saying, you know what heaven's like? It's like a wedding. And you just had recently the First Reformed where, you know, Schrader's idea of heaven at the end, it's heaven's a kiss, basically. You know, that was his idea. So, like, some stuff does, like, you see Schrader coming through a lot, I find.
You know, Schrader has always been, you know, a key point to, or not a key point, but a key element to, you know, some of the great things that Scorsese has done. You know, part of me would have liked to have seen, you know, his, you know, maybe him do a run of a draft on Silence to see what he, you know, what elements he would have brought to it. But in a way, I'm kind of glad he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned First Reformed. What are your, real quick, what are your thoughts on First Reformed?
I think I need to see it again because I came away from it feeling a little bit like, well, that was pretty good, but it's not Schrader's best. And now everyone's telling me that it's Schrader's best. So I feel I should give it a second chance. But
I don't find it to be Schrader's best at all.
I thought it was like he's kind of done the similar thing better in previous films. Like, I mean, a lot of his movies have that characteristic of somebody who's kind of directionless, just eventually falling into this like laser focused mission, you know, like Last Temptation. It's kind of a crime film. Mm-hmm. You know, Jesus is a criminal and the apostles are his gang, and he's not so different from Travis Bickle, kind of finding his focus. And once he gets fixated on this mission, this sort of ultimately violent mission, he has to see it through, and these sort of ideas of self-sacrifice. Like, you do sort of see recurring themes. And of course, Schrader made Mishima, which is probably my favorite film of his. And that's all about this guy kind of, you know, going through this. I think he even wrote Mishima.
Or in the middle.
Working on it, in the middle. Yeah, so like there's some overlap where you see, like, you know, Mishima, it's not quite the same because he's a writer, but like, you know, Jesus going from I Believe in Love to Now I'm the Axe, it's a little bit like Mishima going through his different novels and working on his ideas and following that through line into this idea of a mission that leads to his own suicide, his own self-sacrifice, basically, for his ideals. Like, you know, there's some interesting similarities, you know, once you actually strip the veneer of religion away from Last Temptation to look at what kind of a story it is. Like, it is, you know, in some ways, a very Paul Schrader kind of a story, and a crime story.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's another thing that just sort of makes it feel grounded in a way. It's like I'm not watching preconceived ideas, you know, like we would call them cliches if they weren't religion, but people believe these things, but you know, they always have to be a certain way when you watch it. And it just feels like when I'm watching Last Temptation that I'm seeing these things happen for the first time, you know. I mean, you know, of course, like I'm talking about Schrader now, but like Scorsese, he brings so much to it too. Like, you know, the crucifixion scene, that's like the most depicted, you know, scene in probably all of artwork, maybe. Like, Scorsese finds a way to make it feel like you're watching this for the first time, you know, like the way the crosses look, the way he's positioned. And like, maybe my favorite shot in the film, it's when he has the camera directly behind the cross being raised, and you feel like he's being risen up while he's on the cross. You know, just to think to put the camera there, you know, it completely sets it apart from all these other Jesus films where it's just kind of like, you know, like Passion of the Christ, or like there was that one that came out a little bit more recently, The Son of Man, where it's just like, you know, everything you would expect from a Jesus film. And, you know, Jesus just comes across like you know, some surfer guy is going to play the mandolin and hit on your girlfriend, you know, like, like, you know, Jesus in Last Temptation, he's a character I actually care about and like. And, you know, if you're going to have a religion formed on somebody, you would hope, like, yeah, it's the kind of guy you'd want to go to a wedding with and die for,
you, and that you'll feel for.
Like, I don't know why people have this like knee-jerk reaction when the film basically just asks you to care about this figure, you know, this
because he had sex. That it's
all based on. Right.
Because he had sex, and if you see the film, he really didn't.
No,
but because there's this,
he even had a sexual component that you would even think about it. It's like shocking to people.
No,
I mean, it's like, how can you really be tempted if you're not actually tempted? If it's not a real possibility, like, how can you have faith if you're not actually faced with the possibility of doubt? You know, most people, it's just like, oh, I'm going through the motions. I, you know, this is what I believe because that's what I was born into. And to actually come to that as a conclusion, as a way to live your life, it's maybe another matter.
Right.
I guess, you know.
Yeah.
That's getting a little bit away from the film, but
you know,
I mean, the guy hung out with a prostitute who had the same name as his mom. He's got to have something a little bit off.
What's funny is, and I guess that Kazantzakis really talks about it in the book, and Schrader doesn't put it in the script, though he you know, and it's not even so much alluded to, but in the book, I believe that Mary Magdalene becomes a prostitute because, you know, because Jesus rejected her as a young woman. And
which, like, it seems like a little bit too plotty, actually, even for what the film is.
Well, right.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, no, you're right. It is a little too plotty, though. Schrader, you know, today would probably put it in the film.
Yeah. Well, I wonder, too, if the film were released today, I kind of think there might not be a controversy around it. like, especially, you know, not that.
No, I disagree. I think that people would still, I think people would still be up in arms that Jesus was depicting having sex. You know, it's really in The Last Temptation that, you know, in that sequence where, you know, he finally consummates that relationship with Mary Magdalene. I believe that was the moment in France where, you know, they threw the, you know, the explosives in, you know, to at the screen.
Can't blame it on American prudishness.
No, right. It was even there. It was even in France, too.
French are offended by sexuality. You know, you're playing with
French
fire.
Catholics, I guess. You know, and so, yeah, no, I definitely think that the idea that Jesus could actually get an erection is controversial, and people don't want to accept that. People want to say that he was fully human and fully divine, but they don't want to fully accept the humanity, and that's just wrong. I mean, you know, how does he die for our sins if he doesn't understand what our sins are? How can he make that sacrifice without understanding what it is he's exactly sacrificing for? And so, yeah, no, I definitely think that the film would still be controversial. It's amazing that I think now that it's 30 years old, and you know, you could see it in a different light, but to have a film come out now, especially in the climate with everything else that's going on, you know, it seems like the alt-right would really like...
After this film. Yeah.
You know, ironically enough, at the end of the month here in Brooklyn, Alamo Drafthouse is going to do a screening of it in 35mm. And I hope people get the opportunity to see it the way that it was intended to be seen.
Because I remember when I was in New York.
Yeah, they were showing it at the Quad. Yeah.
I almost went, and it was, I think it started at like 9 o'clock or something, and I thought I'd be leaving the theater around midnight and just didn't head back to Queens at like 1 a.m. But I kind of wish I had gone anyway, since, you know.
Well, you'll get the opportunity, I'm sure.
They'll show it. Like, it seems like, you know, whenever there's a Scorsese retrospective lately, like that's one of the kind of go-to ones. Kundun, not so much, but...
No, and well, I actually got to see Kundun last year on the big screen, which was nice.
Oh, that must have been great. It was gorgeous. Yeah.
Seeing that it's Deakins, I mean...
Yeah.
Deakins is Deakins. You know, I mean, they've never worked together again. I wonder why. But it seems that, you know, Bauhaus and Richardson really get the priority, I guess. I mean, Deakins is with the Coens all the time, too, so...
I mean, you know, Kundun, as amazing as it looks, like, it does have sort of a different feel to it from his other films.
Yeah. Well, I also think that the different feel of Kundun in comparison to The Last Temptation and Silence is that, you know, that was a script that was delivered to Scorsese. It wasn't one that he developed.
Yeah, that was sort of Melissa Matheson's project, yeah.
You know, rest in peace.
Yeah, she passed away recently, and she wrote E.T. and a bunch of Spielberg projects. So I'm kind of surprised it didn't go to Spielberg.
Well, she was talking in the documentary that her agents handed her a list of directors who might, you know, be good for it, and she looked at it and she's like, yeah, but the one I want to send it to isn't on this list, and it was Scorsese. He might not do it, but he'll get it. And of course, I mean, it's totally in his wheelhouse.
It is.
And, you know,
I mean, good on her for realizing that it's in his wheelhouse. Because you're, you know, writing a story about nonviolence and about Buddhism, I think at that time for Scorsese, if you looked at just his films, it might not have been an obvious fit for most people until you see the end product.
No, absolutely. And that's the other thing about Silence is he, you look at that film and you know that's a film that he's thought about for 30 years. Everything is so confident and so assured, and he has completely stripped away everything that he's known for. You know, it's not a booming soundtrack. There's not a ton of elaborate tracking shots. And even the violence, as horrific as it is, isn't...
It's not showy violence. It's
not showy violence at all.
It's really, like, a lot of it's uncomfortable seeing people, you know, tied to crosses as the tides rise, being drowned.
Yeah.
There's one moment when one of the people who apostatized thinks that they're being let go, and then the samurai
gets beheaded,
chops their head off. And it's really just, like, upsetting to see that. You know, it's not like fun movie violence.
Yeah, no, it's not even you know, Casino putting the head in the vice violence. It's oh, whoa.
Yeah.
That dude just got his head chopped off and he's dragged. But then even with that guy that gets beheaded and they drag his body across the ground and you just see, you know, the blood drag, you know, that straight line.
Yeah.
There's a total beauty to it too. And there was also one thing, you know, a Scorsese trademark that I love pointing out. And he hadn't done it in a really, really, really long time, but he does it again in this film, and it's the blood drip. And, you know, you see the blood drip at the end of Taxi Driver when, you know, Bickle puts his, you know, finger up to his head and goes, and then the blood drip at the, Beyond the Ring, in the last fight in Raging Bull, where the blood is dripping off the side of the, you know,
right.
You know, the ring. And then in Silence, where you see the blood drip from, you know, the Christian whose head is hanging on, you know, upside down, you know, underground, and you see that just that little drip of blood. And that's always just been something that, you know, he loves that. He loves that little drip, mm-hmm. You know, it says so much as opposed to, like, you know, that a big bloody, you know, gunshot wound.
Right.
You know, which, I mean, he's done that too, you know, because it's happened. But, I mean, his best violence is the violence that, you know, that is tastefully done or that you don't see. You know, like even Goodfellas when they beat up Billy Batts, you know, when Joe Pesci pistol whips him, you know, it's not so much the, you know, seeing the gun hitting Frank Vincent in the face. It's Joe Pesci's face as he's hitting Frank Vincent.
Right.
And that's what's terrifying about that violence.
He knows how to make you feel it through empathy somehow. Like, I think when the person gets his head chopped off in Silence, it cuts away to the reactions of the people watching and their shock and their scream. And I think,
yeah,
you know, what you feel in that moment, it's less what the person getting their head chopped off felt as the shock of the people around him. And like, he knows where to put you emotionally at any given moment to make you feel the most, you know, for maximum impact.
Since Rodriguez is in that jail too. So he's confined. Mm-hmm. He can't do anything about it. You know, and you feel trapped along with him.
Yes.
And that's is then equally as powerful. Again, of violence is, you know, is quite something.
And
the execution of it.
The execution of it. Yeah.
Back to Schrader real quickly. Because we were talking about First Reformed. For me, First Reformed is a total win until the end.
I thought so too. I think he kind of dropped the ball with the ending.
He could have just hugged her. And it's like, you know, you talk about being influenced by these guys like Bresson and Dreyer and Bergman. And
then the restraint goes out the window. I know.
And he has this mad, passionate kiss with Amanda Seyfried, you know, while he's bleeding. He could have just hugged her. It didn't have to be sexual,
mm-hmm.
You know. So I had to say it because it's been something that's been, you know, people have been out there talking about how it's the best film and blah 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 blah. And you know what? No, it's not.
No.
It's not even his second best film.
It's his best in a little while. So people kind of forget about the great stuff. And I think people are very quick to overpraise certain things just because Like, we want it to be his best film. We haven't seen a good thing from him in a while, and this is, like, the right project for it to be his best film. So they kind of impose that on it, you know.
I mean, like you said, Ethan Hawke does a good job, and I like the roles that he's been taking, and I like the way that he, in the last 10 years or so, since, like, before The Devil Knows You're Dead, he's really done some solid work. But, you know, people are talking about this the way that I wish that more people were talking about Silence.
Yes.
In terms of, like, the whole religious aspect, the whole, you know, suffering and this and that and the other thing. And, you know, I feel like that film has gotten more attention in a weird way than Silence has, even though financially it really hasn't, but I think critically it has.
Critically, it seemed like Silence, I've seen a couple of people come out and praise it, but most people just seem to kind of shrug. They're like, yeah, okay, whatever. You know, like, that was more the reaction. It wasn't even negative. It was just like a big shrug, you know? And I don't, like, especially for me, it felt like after people kind of trashed, you know, Malick's recent films, and people kind of shrugged at this to sort of jump on, oh, First Reformed, it's the greatest, you know, religious film we've seen in ages, and Schrader's best. It felt like, where's this coming from? Like, where was that, you know?
Well, where was that for Silence?
Yeah.
I mean, the Pope saw it. Like, come on, you're talking about a religious movie. The Pope liked it. Like,
yeah.
Let's go.
No, I think, like, I mentioned it to, you know, Lady P on the show on her year in review, but I think basically Hacksaw Ridge got all the, for some reason, that just got the attention that I thought Silence should have gotten. Like, people just seem to go to that film instead.
Yeah.
Which I don't know.
And another thing I wanted to mention, you know, going back to The Last Temptation of Christ and just the sheer, you know, the rawness of it. It owes a lot to Pasolini.
Yes.
And the Gospel According to St. Matthew. And that's a down and dirty Jesus epic for anybody who's looking for another, you know, Jesus movie. You know, that's very much in the vein that Scorsese was going for.
And even the way the miracles are done, like, through the edits instead of trying to do a special effect, you know, the way it cuts when Jesus heals the blind man in Pasolini's version, you know, it's like the cutting away and cutting back to see the tree grow, or, you know, the very simple filmic techniques to express these miracles.
I caught it on some public access channel on Easter in New York on Easter Sunday this year. I was just thumbing through the TV. Actually, I was thumbing, wasn't even thumbing through, like, the TV in my living room that has cable on it. I was thumbing through the TV that I keep in the bedroom that I hooked just an HD antenna up. So I don't know what channels I'm getting from day to day. And I came across this public access channel that was showing a really terrible print of it. And it was brilliant. Like, I don't think I don't want to see a 4K restored version of it. I actually think that the version of it that they have on Filmstruck might be the same print, because that print looks, actually, a lot of those prints of the Pasolini films are in rough shape.
Yeah, I don't know if they were just not taken care of until recently or what, but it's true, like, a lot of them are in rough shape. And I know Criterion came in and cleaned up the Trilogy of Life and stuff like that, but
like, Akatoni is a disaster.
Yeah.
Ugh. You know, and, you know, Marty, if you're listening, we're telling you, you know, these prints are in trouble.
I like what he does for the world cinema stuff.
Oh, the Film Foundation is some of the, there's the Film Foundation and there's the World Cinema Foundation, even though it's all under the Film Foundation. And yeah, the two sets that he's released, you know, on Criterion are great. And his commitment to, you know, films of, like, you know, the films of Edward Yang, and
he'll dive into, like, Kazakh cinema. Like, I was writing this thing about Alexei German a little while ago, and he wrote and produced this Kazakh film, Folovotrar, you know, and I was researching it, and, like, the only Western screening it ever got was through Martin Scorsese. He showed a print of it, and I know that film never got the attention I wish it had, but, you know, he definitely took notice of it, and he's, like, he'll champion Kazakh cinema and Czech cinema and Polish cinema, and, you know, he does actually care, and look into, you know, these sort of film waves and little film communities that don't necessarily get huge international attention, African cinema all over, you know, you can kind of see that. Oh man, I love Tookie Bookie.
You know, he's famous for showing films to his crew, and he, to get inspiration and whatever. And this time, instead of showing multiple films, he only showed one, and he showed Ugetsu.
Right.
Yeah, he didn't show, any Kurosawa. He didn't show any Ozu. He just showed them Ugetsu, and he was like, and you could see a lot of Ugetsu in that, especially with the
when they go to Kikichiro's island, Goto. You know, that like from Ugetsu, that trip through the fog in the boat. You know, it's almost the same. There's a couple pretty. Even the fact that you showed one film to them, that shows restraint. Like this film. Top to bottom, it feels like somebody restrained and focused. Like,
I've thought
this through, and it needs to be this way. So,
right.
I don't know. I think
we've talked more about silence than we've talked about anything.
I guess it was about to happen. I'm pretty.
Yeah, I know.
Like, I think of these three films, Silence is my favorite, and it's hard to know where to place a new film in a filmmaker's body of work that you like a lot. You know, like sometimes you see a new thing and you're like, wow, this is great, this is maybe some of their best work, and then, you know, in a couple of years it doesn't have that same impact on you. But Silence, just watching it, like, it felt like I know I'm going to be watching this in the next 20 years, 25 years longer, you know, like it's just that kind of a film. And it's hard to, like, how do you even compare Silence to some of his other films? Like, how do you compare Silence to Goodfellas even? Like, it's such a different kind of film, and you know, you found a lot of parallels, but it's hard to even compare. But
I have a hard time ranking him at this point. I think Silence kind of put the nail in the coffin on that one, though. But then again, even without Silence, like, for the longest time, I used to tell everybody that Taxi Driver was my favorite film of all time, and above.
Compete with the singularity of Taxi Driver, or the influence of Mean Streets, or...
Well, right, and then that's where Mean Streets comes in for me, because I find that I watch Mean Streets all the time. Like, it's comfort food for me, which is weird, but, you know, that movie of all movies would be considered comforting. You know, but it's, you know... The first 15 minutes of that movie is some of my favorite 15 minutes, you know, ever put on the film.
You know, King of Comedy, which I probably watched more than any of his films, or Age of Innocence, which, you know, like, gives me just a different feeling. Like, you know, some of his films, they just give you something different than what the other ones do. And, like, maybe you can't say it's his best, but that's the only film where I can get this feeling from, you know.
So, right.
Like, Silence... And it's hard to say, like, it feels premature to try and declare it his best film at this point, especially with somebody, you know, with a great career that goes so far back now. But I think, like, maybe if you look collectively, just these three films as a trilogy, like, maybe as a trilogy...
Well, this is the best of the
three.
Maybe
that's his greatest accomplishment. Yeah, and it's the best of the three. So, like, I think...
It's the most realized of the three. I mean, And that's hard for me to say, considering how much I love The Last Temptation of Christ.
Yes.
And how years ago I would have put The Last Temptation, you know, in the top five. Mm-hmm. But I also don't know how to do that with, you know, like, but then there's The Last Waltz. Like, how do I do that?
Right.
Like, you can't do it. I could say that The Last Waltz is a ton better than Shine a Light, you know, and I could say it, but then there's times where, like, yeah, Goodfellas might be better than Casino, but Casino is still really good.
Right.
Like,
Casino, like, yeah, I want to watch Goodfellas, but it doesn't have that Sharon Stone stuff I like, or, you know, like, sometimes you're just, like, you need that thing that he does so well in one particular film, and, like, it almost feels unfair to try to rank them, you know, like, you know, they're different. They're different projects, and
yeah, so. I don't know how to do it. I I've been so connected to the films for so long. It, you know, in a way, it's And in reading about him and listening to him talk and whatever, it's almost like they're all the same film. It's all like the one film. But then again, I would eliminate from this conversation, you know, this the early, you know, the Leonardo DiCaprio stuff.
Right.
I don't know what to do with it. You know, it's a shame because I'm a huge fan and I enjoy the films for what they are. You know, like if I catch The Departed on TV, as much as I hate it, I'll stick with it. Or much as I, as a film geek, want to come out and be like, oh, I hate The Departed, it's no Goodfellas, I'll still sit with it.
I feel like there's like an alternate universe thing out there where like there's a version of Silence that has Leo DiCaprio in the Andrew Garfield role and feels like the inconsequential third part of a trilogy where like, yeah, he kind of said it better with Last Temptation. Like, I feel like it could have easily gone down that route. And, like, you know.
But then again, yeah. I also wondered why he didn't force Leo to do Silence. He was like, you know, Leo, I really did all these other movies for you. You should really come to Silence for me because, you know, it's the only way it's going to get made. And, you know, people will see it because you're in it. And where he turned around, he's like, no, I'm going to go and kill bears instead. See ya.
Right.
But, you know?
Like, I think he would have been wrong for the part.
Totally.
And, like,
sure.
It's not necessarily even saying that, like, Andrew Garfield's a better actor than he is. It's just, like, he fits that
right
part.
Right. I don't know. I mean, then again, maybe, you know, maybe I do have enough faith in Leo, you know, as much as I'm not the biggest, you know, like, rah-rah over their work together. I mean, they did good work. You know, it's good work. It's not terrible.
And
it's just not...
grew as an actor over that period, too. Like, I think...
Well, there's... And he has some moments in The Departed.
Yeah.
He has some moments in The Departed where you're like, oh, wow, he's really acting here. Like, when Martin Sheen falls to his death and splatters all over DiCaprio, like, that reaction's real.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I'm concerned, like, that's real.
Right.
You know, and he has some good moments in Shutter Island, especially at the end. He really sells the end of that film.
I guess more Last Temptation, but there were so many parts that almost went to somebody else when he made it in the early 80s. And
like, well, right. Well, they also backed out.
They all backed out, but like, it's strange to try to picture another version because it feels to be so well cast. Like, you know, when he's talking about... who did they want for Jesus for a while?
Aiden Quinn. When he had it, and then he turned it down.
I'm so happy it's with Defoe because Defoe is there's some eerie otherworldly thing going on about him, and it's not necessarily he can be really sweet and he has that sort of sweet voice through a lot of the film, but he can also be kind of dangerous and you know feel. Like you're in some weird transgressive territory, and like so many of the parts, I know. I've even heard in sort of recently Harvey Keitel getting flack for playing Judas, but like to me, he's like the most down to earth character I've ever seen in like a you know Bible film. It's somebody who's just doesn't understand why it has to be this way, and you know he has such a like common man quality to him in the film, and the way he plays it. You know, I don't know what people expected with accents. Like, that was sort of a big sticking point for a lot of people. But
they didn't get what he was trying to do there.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't get that he was trying to make the Jesus of the streets.
Right.
You know? And that's really what he did. You know, there was always this talk that Scorsese had approached De Niro to play Jesus. And De Niro was like, you know, right. I really don't want to do it. He goes, but if you need me to do it, I will do it. And then Erwin Winkler, who wasn't a producer on Last Temptation, had always made this joke, though, about De Niro and his method. You know, like everybody was so afraid of De Niro wanting to play Jesus because he would want to figure out a way to really put holes in his hand.
Right.
And but that would have been a really, really interesting, you know, combination of having, you know, De Niro as Jesus and Judas as Keitel.
I could actually sort of imagine that working. Like, I know De Niro sort of joked, like, nobody would buy me in a sheet, but, like, it almost feels like that kind of a Jesus film where you could have Robert De Niro as Jesus. And, you know, especially those scenes between him and Keitel. Like, I could actually picture that. And Keitel, like, I almost feel like, like, in terms of acting ability, I always think, like, him and De Niro are pretty comparable. But Keitel will sometimes just take, like, the weirder role, or he'll take a chance with the kind of people he works with. Like it makes sense that, you know, if you were going to give them each a role, like, Keitel would be the one to play Judas. Because it just seems like he's somebody willing to take some of the risks that De Niro would maybe back away from. Like, I was even thinking, watching The Mission recently, you know, when De Niro's practicing with the rapier, the sword, you know, he's striking his poses, and, you know, he looks like, you know, you could take, like, that's the still they use for the movie poster, right? And then I was thinking of Keitel in The Duelists, the Ridley Scott film, and at the very beginning when he's dueling, and he kind of raises his hand in this way that's, like, a little bit fey even, and it's sort of true to the period, but, like, I was just thinking, like, I could never picture De Niro doing that same gesture, even though it's, like, set around the same time, and it's the same kind of, you know, it's just something as simple as that, that I think, like, okay, that's why Keitel would be the one to take roles that are, seem a little bit riskier, like, seem a little bit more dangerous sometimes, and, you know, that doesn't always pay off, but, like, a lot of times it does. I've always felt that way. I don't know if...
I think that Keitel is incredibly underrated now. I think, you know, 20 years ago, when he was at the peak of the independent film movement of the 90s, he was getting the respect that that had long eluded him. And for whatever reason at this point, that kind of faded away. I was a very big fan of Paolo Sorrentino's film, Youth, that came out 2 years ago. And he's absolutely fabulous in it, in a role that I believe was originally offered to Al Pacino first, and he turned it down and recommended Keitel for the part. And I can't imagine anybody but Keitel in that role. But even, like, as recently as Isle of Dogs, Keitel does some incredible voice work in that flick. And but then again, like, you look back at something like Bad Lieutenant, which, you know, was at the beginning of, you know, the rise of this indie film movement. And there's a handful of performances that are as fearless as that. You know,
I mean, there's not many. When I see him is fearless. Like, he'll throw himself into a role without looking back, you know.
You know, it's funny that we touch on Bad Lieutenant because, it, you know, coinciding with the themes of this show or this podcast, you know, that scene in the church between him and Jesus.
When the giant Jesus, that terrified me when I saw it. Like,
And that was another one of those movies that my mother was like, yeah, no, you can't see that. And I had to, basically, like, Ma, come on. I need to see, like, this. This, you know, is important.
Jesus, it's like
it's
like
frightening.
It's a monster almost in that movie.
The work, especially from Keitel, who's Jewish too.
Right.
Like, remember, he's not an Italian Catholic from New York. He's a Jew from Brooklyn.
Right.
You know, and yet he's able to tap into, you know, playing these types of roles and these characters and really getting to the nitty gritty. No, I think that Harvey Keitel is one of our finest actors, and I hope, you know, that he gets, you know, at some point, you know, the recognition that, you know, that he's gotten before. And De Niro and Keitel are one of the great on-screen partnerships. And I think that that's something that doesn't get talked about enough. I mean, even the scenes that they share in a movie like Falling in Love with De Niro and Meryl Streep, I mean, their chemistry in the few scenes that they have together, you know, is incredible. And
presumably they're going to be little together Fockers. Again in is he in The Little Fockers?
Yeah, he's in Little Fockers.
I didn't know that. I've seen the first one, but that was it.
Yeah, no, well.
They're supposed to be in The Irishman together again, right?
Well, you know what? It's funny that you know, that comes up because, you know, Marcus Pinn of Pinland Empire, he's another enormous, you know, Keitel lover, and he doesn't believe that he's in it. And we've seen pictures of De Niro in it, Pacino in right. it and Pesci in it.
I'm amazed.
And Pesci's there's been no.
Even.
No, I know. And it's and it's amazing that that film is even. I don't know what kind of expectation. Well, I have certain expectations about the film. I think the film's going to be their Unforgiven. I really think that it's going to be their statement on violence and this way of life that, you know, the way that I've been talking about how they, how the, you know, the, you know, how people tend to respond to the glamour of it. I have a feeling that this movie is going to try to defunct all that.
Mm-hmm.
At least I hope. At least I hope that's what's happening here. I'm not too sure. I've really tried not to, you know, even though I have a copy of the script, I haven't read it, and I've read half of the book, but I kind of just tried to distance myself from it. And I'm not really crazy about the idea that they're going to digitally de-age these guys.
One of those things I'm sort of iffy about myself, because
you know,
I haven't
because
really
even
seen
if
it,
it
done super well, especially
no,
it sounds like it would be a pretty big chunk of the film.
Yeah, and the other thing before I'm sure you're looking to wrap up here. I think we would be remiss if we really didn't acknowledge, in talking about The Last Temptation of Christ, if we didn't acknowledge Barbara Hershey's contribution to the whole thing.
Yeah, it's because of her it got made, basically.
Well, it was because of her yeah. that Marty discovered the book. I mean, he yes. talks about how a classmate of his at NYU had been telling him about the book for years. But it wasn't until he was on the set of Boxcar Bertha that Barbara Hershey said, "You really should read this book. This is the movie you're going to want to make. And I want to play Mary Magdalene." And he read it and it enamored him and he stuck to it. And when it came time to casting Mary Magdalene, he auditioned her.
Yeah, he like, made her audition.
He didn't make it easy on her. And yet it still became it still was the right person for the role. I
yes.
can't imagine anybody else ever again playing Mary Magdalene in any other movie. It's her. It's ingrained in my head.
The
and
image
she's beautiful.
Of her, like with those tattoos, sweating, like there's a sort of
on her feet,
like the again, you know, it
all
makes
of
it so down to earth. Her idea of, you know, sensuality, like it's very. I don't know, it's accessible. Like, it's not like they tried to make Mary Magdalene, you know, she didn't try to turn the character into, like, a, I don't know, like, biblical sex kitten or something. But,
right.
like, you know, she just feels like a woman
she's
you
a woman.
Could fall for, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And it really is a great performance. It's I think she's underrated. I don't think she gets enough credit. She's really one of, you know, especially the output of work that she did in the 80s.
Yeah, 70s you know? And 80s, yeah.
You know, even in a movie like The Public Eye.
Yeah.
You know, which is another film that people, you know, kind of gotten forgotten about. But she's, you know, she's something else.
Yeah.
So,
I think we've talked them all to death, basically. But I feel like I
could
have kept
going. I mean...
But...
Yeah. You know, you know, John Lurie's in it too, and
oh man,
you know.
Harry Dean Stanton as Paul.
Oh,
I just
Harry
love that
Dean Stanton.
So much. Yeah, I mean, that's another. There's a few people from these films that we've lost recently. They're getting to that age, but Harry Dean Stanton. I think like there's no such thing as a film that's entirely pretentious that has Harry Dean Stanton in it. He just brings it all down. Like you know, I was talking a little while ago on the podcast about Alien. And, you know, it's a science fiction movie, but as soon as you have, like, Harry Dean Stanton up there with a baseball cap, it's like, oh, this is really happening. This isn't giant rubber space monster. Like, he just has that quality about him that, like, you can totally believe any situation he's in. He's sort of, I don't know, he's great. And you have that scene where they have to kill Lazarus. Like, that's a real Scorsese gangster hit
yes.
scene. Yeah.
Yes. But even that delivery of that speech... You know, as Paul is,
yep.
you know, his whole sequence in that film is one of, in terms of sheer delivery of that monologue is one of my favorite moments in that film. I've talked about it before. But Harry Dean Stanton is just one of the coolest dudes ever. I mean, best friends with Jack Nicholson. And then even the
all the way back to like those like Monty Hellman westerns, you know, him with an eye patch and stuff. Like he's been in my mind, he's been like an old man. He was an old man forever. Like he was just always kind of at that same age that he would play for decades. So,
you know, and seeing him in something like Straight Time.
Yeah.
You know, probably my favorite Dustin Hoffman movie, but when they're robbing the bank or robbing the jewelry store rather, and they're like, come on, let's go. Yeah. Like, you know, his delivery, his acting and his reacting. I mean, he is a true character actor. Yeah. I'm grateful that, he went out on top with Lucky. I mean, Lucky is a really, really good movie. If you haven't seen, John Carroll Lynch's Lucky, you should really check it out. It's really, really a special film.
That was a film I sort of put off for a little while. I didn't want to see it right away because, like, I knew I was just going to cry. Like, I had to kind of be in the right mood to see it.
Right.
Because he's only had a couple of starring roles, like Paris, Texas.
Right.
You know, Lucky, that's all his film. And I don't... If you see it, it's really moving. I was like sobbing actually, you know, just thinking about his death and thinking about life and his attitude towards it. So,
yeah, no, that's a really, really, really great film. You know, underseen, I think at this point, but it is on, I believe it is currently streaming on Hulu in the States. I don't know if there's a difference. I mean, you know, most of the time there's not a difference.
Yeah.
Like, but sometimes Netflix there is
and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. In terms of cast, I mean, who else? I mean,
I like Andre Gregory as John the Baptist. That's a great bit of casting. Like I was thinking of his role in Mosquito Coast, where he plays sort of like a, almost like a televangelist at one point, but you know, this like sort of pious guy who goes to the jungle, but, that was also written by Schrader, but it's such an unusual casting choice. Like, oh, it's Andre from My Dinner with Andre as John the Baptist, but
he
works really well in that. I don't know. The film's full of
Robert Blossom is in it too.
Character actors. Yeah.
I mean, I think that I prefer, you know, we were talking about alternate casting. Sting was supposed to be Pilot. Mm-hmm. In the 1983 version of it, I prefer David Bowie.
I prefer David Bowie.
I couldn't imagine David Bowie as an thing. Actor.
Like I can never get enough of him.
You know, Victor Argo, another New York character actor who, you know, you've seen him in everything, but you know he's in that too,
right?
You know, Paul Herman, another one
as Apostle Peter, right?
Oh, yeah, Victor Argo is Peter, yeah, you know?
Yeah, like...
Yeah, it's just...
Usually he's in something where he's waving a gun around, or, like...
No, right,
you know,
right.
Yeah. He's in, like, Abel Ferrara films, and he's in, like, those kinds of movies. Like, Last Temptation of Christ is one of those kinds of movies. It's not Ben-Hur, it's not, you know, The Robe, any of
these.
No,
it's more in line with Mean Streets and with Bad Lieutenant and those films, just because it's, you know, set in the desert doesn't mean that it's not set in the streets.
Right.
And in a way it is, you know, they're outside most of the film.
And I know, like Scorsese talked about all his life, basically wanting to make a Bible epic. And he talks about, you know, when he was a kid doing these storyboards for a Sword and Sandals kind of a film. And like, I think it's interesting that when he finally had the chance to make something like that, he had the lowest budget possible to make a film like that, and basically made one that just felt completely different from anything else. You know, like you said, that the Pasolini films, just about all you can compare it to in terms of religious films. But I like it.
I like it too.
Been able to tell, like it's.
I like it too. I also grew up, you know, a big music guy, and actually grew up a big Genesis fan. Mm-hmm. And to have the Peter Gabriel connection to The Last Temptation of Christ, especially at a point where Peter was at the height of his popularity, because by the time that this film had come out, he had finally had the commercial success that basically eluded him once he left Genesis.
Right.
But it you know, Peter's score, though a little dated at this point, which is, it's sad to say, but I don't care. I still think it's a fabulous score. Whereas the Philip Glass score really holds up.
Yeah, that I mean, it's very similar to the score in Mishima, but it's
yeah, very similar. Sort of, yeah,
cerebral mood it puts you in. I find that works really well, and it's just that rhythmic driving. I find gives the film a lot of energy because it's in a lot of regards kind of stately. There's a lot of people sitting and meditating. It's not the same kind of movement that you normally have in a more dynamic Scorsese film, but you know, the film gives you the impression that like all the movement's on the inside, and there's a lot of the editing in conjunction with these visions or, you know, little things like that done to give it a dynamicism that isn't necessarily inherent to the script. You know, like, I mean, there's that one part near the end when the people who helped the Dalai Lama escape, you know, he sort of looks back and he sees a vision of them dead on their horses, you know, knowing that these people are going to have to go back and they're all going to get killed. And it's just done with an edit. And like, there's so much energy in that, the way it's done, you know, even though it's depicting something completely internal, you get what he's thinking about. You get why he acts the way he does. You know, it's, I did a side by side on Twitter. Like it almost made me think of the Shining, like of all things, when Danny's seeing the two girls in the hallway and there's the cut to the dead. Like there's some kind of similar quality of making you understand how a vision works. And I know Scorsese's mentioned Kubrick pretty often, but I thought maybe that was an unlikely place it might have ended up. And some of his decisions, I think, are just mind blowing. How he, you know, when you hear about the bombing of the monastery, to show you, you know, visually what the Dalai Lama's feeling, how he feels compassion for all these people who have died in the bombing of the monastery. And you have that shot where he's standing in the middle of all those monks and it pulls out and out, almost like a shot of the mandala. And you just have all these monks in red on the ground dead. Like, I don't know, like it's really breathtaking and just hasn't left my mind in all these years since I've seen the film. It's just one of those things that's completely stuck in there forever.
No, and I feel the same way about, you know, the end of, you know, The Last Temptation with the, you know with, you know, it is accomplished in the way that the music swells up and, you know, his eyes close and the light starts to flicker and that, you know, happy accident occurred and then those drums kick in. I mean, it's just, you know, it's...
That's a perfect ending. You know, that's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, these films are really special. And I think if people are looking for, you know, some sort of enlightenment or to feel or to, I don't know, maybe get closer to God in their own way without having to go worship or go to church, this might be a good way to do it.
I mean, movie theaters, that's the best place for it, I found in my own life. That's the place to do it. Like...
What?
You know, that scene in Last Temptation where Jesus pulls his heart out and shows it to them.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like that's what Scorsese is doing with something like Silence. Like, you just, you know, see right into somebody else's soul, into their mind, into their life, you know, when you watch this film. It completely feels emotionally so open and honest and, you know, struggling with something very deep and essential to our nature that, you know, for me, that's... I guess that's religion, basically, you know, when you go out and see a movie that means a lot to you, that it's like a religious experience almost, even as weird as that might sound to people. Yeah.
Well, and like, you know, I mean, the great religious experiences I've had have occurred, you know, at the cinema, you know, or at a live show, you know, Harvey Keitel talks about it, you know, he talks about having something taking you from here to there. And I think that's, you know, what these films have done. It's taken me from one place and brought me somewhere else, you know, for better or for worse. I mean,
there's those films you see in your life. Maybe there's not a lot of them. Like I found, and there's probably less than 10 real ones, but it's like you go in not really with the high expectations or anything, but it's like, oh, everything's different now. Movies are different now. My life's different now. Like you come out and it's just like, oh, okay, everything's changed, you know? Like that happens once in a while. I mean,
in the last 10 years, I can only think of a handful of films that have done that to me. And Marty is a filmmaker. I mean, he gets pigeonholed by the popular consensus as an Italian American gangster filmmaker. Mm-hmm. You know, I wish that he was more pigeonholed as a humanist and a spiritual filmmaker. Even look at George Harrison, Living in the Material World, where that's all about a spiritual journey. And trying to, you know, live your life with love and compassion and, you know, trying to attain some sort of enlightenment, you know, but silence is where it's at. Silence is where, yep. is where, yeah. you know, as a generation.
Isao Ogata, like, we talked about it already, but like, good God, what a performance, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Christians would stop causing me so much trouble. Like, the way he says it.
That moment where he walks away from him.
Yeah.
And you hear him say, a barren woman can never be a true wife. But he walks away and the sound drowns out with him. It was such a wonderful technical choice. And Marty's really good at playing with sound. In a way where other filmmakers don't play with sound as much as they should.
Sound editing and the sound mixing are getting like lazier and not lazy, but like rushed. I know a lot of like sound people who just don't get the time to work on films that they used to. Like, you know, that what used to be like weeks has been crushed into days, and what's been days has been crushed into hours. Like, you know, they just expect more from sound editors and sound mixers now. That to see something like Silence, where it's very conscious of these sounds, like the first, you know, before you see any image in the film, you just hear the sounds of the wilderness, the crickets chirping, and then that cuts out and you have the total silence. It's very conscious of what you're hearing at any given moment, you know, when the sound drops out, when God finally speaks. Those moments, like, why even have an Oscar for best sound mixing if something like this can't get nominated? Like, I don't know.
No, right. And the reason that this is because, you know, producers, you know, think the technology, you know, just because it's so easy, you know, they rely on it to be quick and efficient. And really, the technology is there for you to be more creative, not to be rushed. You know, and that's the benefit and the downfall of digital all the way around.
Right.
You know, and not even just in terms of audio recording, but in, you know, video processing. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you know, everybody talk, you know, you still need to light the shot. You know, I don't care if you're shooting on, you know, DV or HD or 16 millimeter, you still need to light the shot. And, you know, I don't care if you're, you know, recording in mono or in stereo or with Pro Tools or, you know, with a tape recorder, you still need, you know, to adjust the levels and you still need to make sure that it plays right in, you know, the proper setting. I went to see 2001 the other night.
Oh,
in
me 70, too.
Yeah, and the,
I went with my girlfriend for we went on Canada Day, saw the 70 millimeter print.
I did too.
Yeah,
and which was great. You know, everybody should go see it, even if you don't like it. Like, you should just go see it. Like, it's a movie event of the summer. Like, it looked great. And man, there's that moment with that long beep. I think I went deaf. For about 10 minutes.
At the beginning with the monolith, and it was really loud, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it was the loudest I've ever heard. I've seen it in theaters before, but...
Yeah, no, it was wild. It was wild.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. When they're on the moon and they hear it and they're holding their helmets.
Like, yes. That was yes, really loud. Yes.
Remember.
Oh. I couldn't wait for the intermission at that point. I was like.
I'd heard things I'd never heard before in the film. Like, you know, towards the end when he's in that little Renaissance room and you can hear in the background these like little alien voices or something. Like there's a chatter right. going on as if he's being watched, you know. And I guess Kubrick wanted it to be like he's in a alien zoo. So, but there's right. voices and they're really faint, but stuff like that. The fact that there's even information there, like the fact that there's even sound there shows that some thought went into it. And I, you know, it's sort of a different experience when you can hear it louder or hear it more clearly, depending.
That's a movie that never worked at home for me, but I've seen it now twice in 70 millimeter, once 2 years ago and once the other night. And it was,
yeah,
it's everything. Everybody's, it just doesn't. It doesn't work at home. I don't care how big your TV.
I
don't care how big your TV is.
Yes.
I don't care what kind of, you know, it might work with the 4K Ultra HD. I'll let you know in October, but I doubt it.
I think that's right. Cause like when I watch it on home video, it never really, I start noticing the pace. I start noticing like there's some scenes I don't like actually. And then on theater, in the theater, it like completely grabs my attention. And the way we watched it, like we had, you know, we had the overture and the curtains open and there's an
yeah.
intermission. Like at the end, you know, my girlfriend was saying like, it felt like up till then she had just been watching bastardized versions of what movies were supposed to be. Like, oh, this is the proper way to do it, you know.
Correct.
With the intermission and everything and the projection like that. It was the right way to show a movie.
And that's how I saw it. It's a mad world. I saw the 70 millimeter Rocho and that's the way to do it.
There's a few films like that, but I don't know. Well, thank you for coming on. And I don't know if there's any place on the internet, if you want people to find you, Twitter or anything.
Oh yeah. Like no, that. Well, I'm on Twitter at Rob Cotto. So at R-O-B-C-O-T-T-O.
It's almost without fail. I know when I post something Scorsese related, I just look and sooner or later I see a like by you. So that's good to know that somebody checks those out.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely.
And thank you for coming on. And if folks want to follow the show, the Twitter's at FlixWise. There's a Facebook page. The website's FlixWise.com. I'm on Twitter at Movie Kessler. And and until next time, take care.
All right.
It is accomplished. It is accomplished.